What you, Direno, have failed to do in a number of years, De Karnak and I will accomplish in a matter of days. Yes?
Yes, Your Majesty.
Even such a pair of imbeciles must realize that Robin Hood flourishes because the people trust him. He'd never survive without their support.
We mean to undermine that support, explained De Karnak.
By getting the people on our side, Sheriff. Generous and caring, that will be the new image of the king and his servants. Do you follow me?
Of course, De Karnak.
An era of tolerance and justice. Even charity.
For the moment. As for Robin Hood, the people's hero, De Karnak will soon tarnish that image, will you not, De Karnak?
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday the 22nd of July 2022, we're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol. And on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. The stream is just a generic address, so if and when we have to change streams, talkradio.org.uk is all you need to have bookmarked. You will find us. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with this military-grade Ukraine psyops, and also, of course, the COVID medical misinformation, where an estimated, according to Dr. Tess Laurie in Bath, 60,000 Brits could have died unnecessarily. Those London media lies all forgotten, and more lies yesterday from the BBC and the High Court, caving in to complete nonsense about Martin Bashir. We'll be going into that in a bit of depth later on. But anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Joining us too in the studio here is solicitor and former Brexit Party candidate Ian Barclay. In part one, the Bristol Clean Air Zone is not necessarily even on the council's own pollution measures. According to a Freedom of Information request, it doesn't justify its own existence. The air sampling on the A4 Portway has shown it's never been justified there. So why is this clean air zone going into a place which has never even got close to the clean air minimums? It's a green tax on the poor and disabled in reality. Just a toll, really, being implemented by a fake Labour mayor here in Bristol. The council also have been spying on councillors and parents of disabled children who won a successful legal challenge against them over the SEND, the special educational needs that they were not providing for these people, that they should have provided and they had to legally provide and they didn't provide. And also a rally against the cashless society last Saturday in Bristol. We hear from one of the speakers. Another thing, the Ford report into attacks on Jeremy Corbyn from within the Labour Party is released. And the BBC, as I said, give Martin Bashir another hard time. And Prince Charles' former aide, £200,000. Plus, they reiterate the ban on the licensing any of Bashir's devastating 1995 Diana Panorama interview. Now, I think actually quite a lot of people think that's an important historical document, but apparently not, according to the BBC now, it's not going to be shown at all, ever. And they won't license it either. But Martin Bashir is about as discredited as Andrew Wakefield. Why are we character assassinating our heroes? And, by the way, what really happened to Princess Diana? And in part two, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is changing his tune. He says the Russians' ambitions are now beyond their breakaway Russian-speaking Donbass region, and they are interested in other parts of Ukraine. Well, surprise, surprise, we'll be discussing that with Martin. Plus, Russia's Putin and Turkey's Erdogan are in Tehran, have been this week, to agree peace moves in Syria without any UK or US in the room. It would be interesting to be a fly on the wall there. And also, a former ITV documentary producer who started in the Bristol Evening Post in the 1950s, Peter Williamson, he meets James Jesus Angleton, the domestic counterintelligence chief at the Central Intelligence Agency. He did meet him back in the 1960s and 70s, and he gives us his considered verdict on Iraq. So, Iranian and Russian news cancelled first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom too, and cancelled off Bristol Community FM, even the great Community FM Bristol by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here. So anyway, welcome Ian Barclay to the studio. Could you want to just tell us a bit about the Brexit Party and how you got started with them?
Well, I got started because at the time I thought the country should actually get out of Europe, and the party was going to offer the best chance. As it happened, the election took place, they did a deal with the Tories, and probably helped them get the best results with a leader who did phenomenal. Sad that they dumped him, probably because he's said too many lies. As to me, I'm a solicitor, works for local authorities, dealing with children, picking up the problems and advising social workers. And just took a choice to stand for a party for one moment.
Okay, right. So the Brexit Party, what did you learn about politics in those, what was it, a couple of years?
Yeah, well, definitely a couple of years. It was an interesting period. I learnt that both the Conservatives and the Brexit Party were quite close. I learnt that both Labour and Liberal Democrats were quite close, and it was really quite a friendly party. All the people together campaigning. They present an image, they just don't necessarily tell the truth. That's what I learned.
So are you saying there's some of the same figures behind the scenes?
I think so. I think a lot of it, from my experience, what it needs is really honest and open politicians. And I don't think any of them that I have seen recently are honest with the public about what's really going on.
So have you seen these queues today down in Dover? You're wondering maybe whether Brexit wasn't such a clever idea after all?
Well, I think we should have gone through and got Brexit done and then said to the country, compare what we had with what we've got. You know, we were in Europe and we were never really in Europe. We never really made an effort of it. So in leaving, we should have made the effort and then said to the country, compare the two differences. Rather than fighting to stay in, we should have said, we're going to leave, put it all in place, give the country a second say.
You know, there's an interesting parallel we'll be talking about in a minute, and that's the Corbyn faction of the Labour Party. In a way, that was a kind of Brexit faction, because Jeremy Corbyn was a Brexiteer before, wasn't he, Martin?
But he wasn't by that time.
Yeah, but he somehow, so his arm was twisted behind his back, wasn't it? He wanted to play kumbaya with the Remainers, but, which didn't really work. But anyway, what advice have you got for Labour about how they can do, I mean, because the Brexit Party and UKIP did manage to persuade the Conservative Party to bite the bullet and actually have that referendum. I think that's pretty clear. It seems that, you know, although the Brexit Party and UKIP didn't have any great electoral success except in Brussels, where it didn't really matter for here, the Labour Party's never managed to do that with its left wing.
I don't think the Labour Party at the moment is connecting. The people that ran the party, the roots and the people at the bottom of it need to take control. The top has taken over and it's losing its identity. So from my experience, when I went up to Wrexham and I stood there, I met miners who'd supported Labour 30, 40 years, said, we're voting Conservative. I said, why? Because they're not listening. It was as simple as that.
Is that true, Martin? Do you think that there's an element of this sort of leafy North London suburb Labour Party that have just lost touch with the working class roots?
Well, the party has always been a coalition of different demographics. And, of course, there's always been a pretty vicious infight between the right of the party and the left of the party. If we had a proportional system, as they do in other European countries, there'd be two parties.
Well, yeah, you're always full of this wishful thinking. Of course, it would be a nice to think like that, but you have to deal with things as they are. Asking you, Ian,
yes.
Do you think it is possible for, within the Labour Party, for a faction to do something, to kick the central party into action, a bit like the Brexiteers did to the Tories?
Oh, definitely, but I'm going to take a view on Italy and proportional representation. They've had more governments than any other country since the Second World War, so they haven't had the stability. Proportional representation can work if the party that's actually elected first past the post then brings it in. It's trying to change the system when you haven't won to do it. In terms of what Labour needs to do, they need to look at their leadership and say they're not listening to the voters. Clearly up north they're not listening. Conservatives, I think they've managed to shoot themselves in the foot. Boris had a chance to really make a difference to this country. Whether you like it or not, he had a majority that could really make a difference. And on all the really important issues, he chose the wrong way to go.
Well, which were they?
Well, if you take the lockdown, I mean, Sweden came out of this, didn't lock down, did quite well. It's about the same death rate we had. In terms of economics, they gave a lot of money to people who ran businesses. Instead of saying, let's double unemployment. At that period, for anybody who's made unemployed, let the rich look after themselves, because they are. We'd have come out without 300 billion, and now it's something like 17 billion a month in interest payments. The country can't afford it.
Martin?
Well, obviously,
the lockdown was very expensive.
Well, the lockdown's very expensive all over the world. It wasn't
where they did it. Yeah.
Yeah, where
Belarus didn't. Did
no, all right. Well,
neither did India or Pakistan. No. Or the really important countries.
But as you will know, in the second hour, Tony, we'll come to discuss biological warfare because that's what that issue is all about.
I don't know if we will actually, but we're talking about it now, Martin.
Okay, well, let's talk about it now. Lockdowns, obviously. You don't want to lock down, but what they actually did is they didn't lock down soon enough, in my view. You're not going to agree. I think the New Zealand Labour Party called that one right. Boris Johnson has gone now, or is still there. I don't believe that Brexit will stand in the end, because the single market isn't going away. Even if the EU collapses, and that's quite possible, the EU may well collapse as a political institution. The single market will remain, and every country in Europe is in the single market apart from us. So that's why we've got huge problems at our borders.
So do you think we're going to be actually forced...
And we've lost 4% of GDP
the Tory
already.
Party, Marty, you seem to be saying the Tory Party's going to be forced to go back into the single market.
Well, Tom Tugendhat did in fact suggest that, which is one reason why he's never going to be Prime Minister. And somebody is going to be Prime Minister who does believe in leaving the single market and obviously ripping up the Northern Ireland Protocol. That implies a trade war with our neighbours. And that implies a great deal of economic hardship.
So it's a trade war been going on for the last couple of years?
It started because when you've got freedom of movement of goods and then you stop having that, that puts a cost on business. And the costs of Brexit are now becoming absolutely clear. If you read Chris Hedge's Beyond Brexit blog, and he's a top analyst of what goes on around this, and he's a Remainer, the economic facts of Brexit are staring everybody in the face. And, of course, nothing can be done about it because it's become a sacred cow that cannot be slaughtered.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think there's still quite a lot of Romaniacs out there.
Yes, in Scotland there's loads of them.
Reverse,
in Ireland.
And not in Wales. And not in England.
In Wales, if you look at the opinion polls now, more than half the population think it was a bad idea. Only 28% of people think it was a good idea.
I'm not so sure
about that. That's the reality. Yeah, well, that's the opinion poll turn.
Can I just interject here? A lot of what you said is fascinating. But if you'd actually read the treaty we signed, Boris knew there was going to be a border in the North Sea. He knew British businesses that shipped into Northern Ireland would have to pay the duty up front and claim it back. But he also knew X number of years down the road, there is an opt-out that we can walk away and we go back to world trade. I think Boris miscalculated. And if he had got through and carried on and made the right changes after he got into power, which he never did, because we haven't had a correct Brexit yet, leave, it would be a different situation today.
Well, what I take from that is that whatever Brexit we get is not going to satisfy the true Brexiters, because it's like chasing gold at the end of the rainbow.
What about all those Labour voters that voted Brexit and they rejected Corbyn because he was so half-hearted about it all?
The Labour vote was split, but it was split about two-thirds, one-third. The big cities where the Labour vote really piles up were all solidly Remain, as was Northern Ireland, of course, which is a crucial thing. In everything that's going to unfold now, because we're going to see a breakup of the United Kingdom, just like a breakup of Ukraine, and there's going to be a global economic crisis, and it's not
so
just
Ian,
going to be about
Ian,
our parochial stuff.
Do you agree with Martin?
Stuff.
You think it's going to be the United Kingdom is going to break up?
The way it's going at the moment, Northern Ireland is an issue, always has been, and there's a provision in the Northern Ireland Peace Treaty for a referendum for unification. So the Sovereign's going to use that as a justification. No, I think Brexit has to be done properly. I take free trade being the answer. I note that Europe has a lot of problems economically. We don't have to be involved with Europe. We can trade around the world and we trade ourselves out of it.
60% of our trade is with our neighbours.
Well,
for obvious reasons.
But a large chunk of it is with America, and we should be looking towards there, which is one of our largest markets. We also have Australia and New Zealand. I'm not sure I agree with Boris, what he did in terms of the changes for New Zealand bringing products over here, because it's gone against our farmers.
Yep.
I think Boris got in with the right views, but I think he was stymied by his Chancellor and other people around him who gave him the wrong advice. And they were advising him so they could politically annihilate him and take over.
OK, well, you mentioned farmers there. I've got a great clip of thinking about farmers this week from George Monbiot speaking on RTE, the Irish broadcaster. They're not like a licence fee. They have adverts on RTE, which is on the radio and on television over in Ireland. And they have a very sensible system whereby they have an office which takes the advertising revenue, which is a long way away from the office which makes the programmes. So the advertisers don't get to tell the people that make programmes anything. So they just take the money and then they feed it over to the programme makers. So which is quite a good way. Not the way, of course, that the commercial broadcasters like Sky, etc. do it here. But anyway, over on Irish RTE, here is the Guardian columnist and environmentalist, the guru for Extinction Rebellion, George Monbiot, speaking about his zero animal farming.
This country, George, there's a big emphasis on agriculture and how agriculture needs to cut its emissions. And I know it's an issue you feel very strongly about. You've said that agriculture is arguably the most destructive industry on earth. Explain, and do you still believe that, George?
It's by far and away the greatest cause of habitat destruction, the greatest cause of wildlife loss, the greatest cause of extinction, greatest cause of soil loss, greatest source of fresh water use. It's one of the greatest causes of climate breakdown, bigger than transport, one of the primary causes of water pollution and of air pollution. So it's right at the top. Oh, and sorry, I forgot to say land use, the biggest issue of all. It's by far and away the greatest form of land use that humans inflict on the planet, which means all that land is land which can't be used for wild ecosystems. And while obviously we need farming, we need to minimise those impacts. We need to act as drastically within that sector as any other sector to prevent the collapse of our life support systems. And what that means above all else is getting out of livestock farming, is really shutting down animal farming altogether, because that has massively disproportionate impacts on the living planet. And we need to switch towards other sources of food, plant-based diets, which are far more efficient, far lower environmental impacts, but also switch out of farming altogether to produce protein-rich foods, which we can do through precision fermentation, brewing,
George,
microbes.
I can hear farmers all over this small country of ours shocked and perhaps screaming at their televisions, because they're saying, are you saying all animal farming, in your opinion, really needs to stop?
Yes, it does. It really does. It's a bit like leaving fossil fuels in the ground. Unless we do that, we've really got very little chance indeed of preventing this domino effect of system collapse right across Earth systems, which basically makes the planet uninhabitable. So eating meat and milk and eggs is an indulgence we cannot afford.
That's the environmentalist and Guardian columnist, George Monbiot, speaking on RTE earlier this week. And he says an enormous amount of interesting, peculiar. Anyway, Martin, do you want to just respond to what you've just heard about the idea that the livestock farming's got to go?
Well, George Monbiot has got a very, you know, he's got quite a big platform, hasn't he, in The Guardian and so on. That is a very extreme view.
He seems to also have his own, he's almost his own little team of activists that will go out and stop a city for him.
Well, I think the thing about what he's saying is that there is a view out there that you know, Arnie Nice was the founder of what might call deep greenery, which sees human beings as the problem. In the more mainstream green movement, for example, you're going to have people who would be supportive of the farmers' strikes in India, where they're actually demanding to retain traditional agriculture and prevent multinationals from coming in and taking over the marketing boards and so on, which was set up with kind of semi-socialist policies in India. Traditionally, Greens have always been supportive of small farmers. And, of course, small farmers also led revolutions in places like Nicaragua, where they kicked out the Somoza dictatorship and redistributed the land. And they're still, Sandinistas are still in power in Nicaragua through democratic means. I think that the Monbiot agenda that we're listening to there is aligned with the World Economic Forum and with the idea that the top multinationals and corporates are deciding that they are the Greens, which is actually an appropriation of a political movement. And it's rather sad.
The land is for the wild ecosystem and growing vegetables.
I think he's missing the point. You've got to sell this to the people at the bottom. People actually live their lives. And if you dictate to people, they tend to turn off. And while a lot of what he says may be seen as sensible in terms of the use of land, at the moment farmers in this country are turning to putting solar panels on their farms because they can't make a living farming.
Well, isn't it peculiar? I was having a chat to a farmer from Ludlow a few weeks ago who was saying, explaining that, you know, there are, he won't do it, but a lot of other farmers around him do this set aside, which I think he said something like 4 or 5 years you're allowed to take a field, do absolutely nothing with it, and then you have to use it for at least 1 or 2 years. Now, there's a lot of land like that that's just not being used at all.
That's the problem the country has. We should have had Boris saying, we're going to dig for victory, we're going to move on from Europe, we're going to turn the country around, make it self-sufficient on food. He did the opposite.
Is it possible, do you think, to be self-sufficient in food here?
Yes, we did it in the Second World War. Well,
we've got quite a few more people living here now.
And also the Battle of the Atlantic to bring lots of stuff in. Well, we didn't grow it all in Britain,
no, did we? But the point is, you start by getting the people on side. So then you say, right, we want to change the country. Boris had a chance to have people working from home. He had that chance to do away with all the cars on the road, because at the period when we had lockdown, pollution was disappearing. He could have been bold and said, let's say people have to work at a location, we'll give them a tax break. But everybody could work from home, makes it easier. In my own profession, all lawyers loved it. It was brilliant, because we were at home doing hearings and not travelling.
I tell you who
country.
Didn't love it was the Murdoch press. Well, and they got their Tory mouthpieces to denounce it.
To be fair to the Murdoch press, they're rich enough to look after themselves.
Well, I know, but the point is, they don't just look after themselves. They stick their fingers in and they tell people what to think.
They dominate quite a lot of the conversation. One of the most interesting things that George was saying there is about this whole idea of the climate actually being far, sorry, that land use being far more of an effect on the climate than aircraft or cars and transport, this sort of thing. Now, I just find that a little bit difficult to process, because that's what they've been talking about for such a long time, is about all this use of fossil fuels. Well, how much fossil fuels are used, say, growing corn? Okay, so a tractor going backwards and forwards, a bit of fertilizer. And he's now saying that, you know, we're now going to have to go back to organic agriculture, this sort of thing. Now, you're absolutely right, Martin. This is all aligned with this World Economic Forum thing. And there's been, and also this zero carbon agenda. Mm. We've reported on here over the last few weeks, these new companies which are being set up to do what they call carbon offset. So what they do is they buy up farmland, they plant lots of little sapling trees all over it, and it turns out that the local farmers can no longer afford land, because the price of land in South Wales has gone up tremendously, because all this land is now being just used for trees. This does seem to be a financial incentive behind this, which is, you know, say, for example, a young couple just starting a farm want to buy a few acres, they now can't do it.
It depends how you're going to run a country. You've got to start working out what is better for the majority of people. If you look at the tax system, we currently have PAYE people at the bottom of tax, 20%. If you have millions in shares, you pay less tax. There should be a change fundamentally. As you say, all income earned is taxed at the same rate. It's a fundamental change. We have to stand up as people, not believing it's billions that make a difference. It's individuals.
Well, I mean, you go around the countryside now and you will see quite a lot of the smaller streams are dried up. Or, I mean, particularly obviously this time of year. But there's definitely less water flowing around our rivers and streams than there was, say, 30, 40 years ago. And I can remember, this is a long time ago, doing a piece for the BBC down in Salisbury, and having a fascinating chat by a guy who was saying, well, we've had lowering water levels for the last 3 or 4 years, ever since the water was privatised, because these private companies have got permissions to sink boreholes and actually take a lot more water out of the aquifers than ever was allowed before. And this was something which was, you know, in the old water boards were public meetings where they would have to justify what they were doing in front of the public, local councillors, etc. Nowadays, you've got private companies saying, stick a borehole down there, let's get loads and loads more water. And that's the reason, not George, I'm afraid, because of the fact that we are such a massive industrial power. The real industrial power on Earth, Martin, is surely China, actually. And there is, obviously, we've had one of the hottest weeks ever in Britain, apparently, if you believe the Coningsby temperature just above the surface of the runway there at 40 degrees or 41 or whatever it was. There's clearly something going on, but it does look as if this is mostly being generated by your beloved Chinese Communist Party in China, this global warming. The Industrial Revolution stopped here a long, long time ago.
Listen, I'm not... Yes, and of course, as we've discussed week after week, when I was in the New Economics Foundation, in the 90s, Aubrey Meyer came in and founded the Global Commons Institute.
Well, I'm not talking about that, Martin. I'm saying that what we're being told here is we've got to get rid of our livestock animals in Britain. Nothing is being done about stopping the building of, say, coal-fired power stations and polluting carbon-emitting power generation in China, which is where it's all going on. And, of course, there's not really access, easy access, but British journalists to find out exactly what's going on in China. It's not a free society.
Can I quickly add that Germany is now opening up coal again for its energy because they found that they got a shortage because it's so reliant upon gas. It's the policies and the planning that have gone through in the last 20 years did not consider the individuals. They considered a dream of zero pollution. And it can be achieved, but not at the price of the individuals being crippled financially. We're now getting the end result of a country that doesn't have the oil. We could have the oil, the gas, the shale, to be independent.
We could have coal. There's quite a lot of coal around too. But indeed, we've got this zero carbon. We've had zero COVID, which Martin is quite into in China and New Zealand. It now seems we've got zero agriculture too. It doesn't seem as if there's going to be much of a future without any of these.
Population, though, could be one of the problems. The Earth itself is overpopulated. We need to have a realistic discussion about how you deal with that. It's the people at the bottom, my view, taking over and saying to Parliament, you got it wrong. It's time for a change.
Do you think George Monbiot is going to get anywhere with this campaign to stop livestock farming? I can remember probably 15 years ago first hearing that, cows are too flatulent and this is contributing to the climate change.
I think when you're trying to change anything, you've got all sorts of vested interests and problems of whatever you're trying to do.
Bill Gates is buying up all this farmland, isn't he? Bill Gates is developing all these systems for growing protein in test tubes that George is talking about there.
Yes, and I think that is what Monbiot is saying is in a sinister way aligned with that agenda. The real problem is we're on the brink of world war between Russia, China and the West, and therefore we can't negotiate with the Chinese about what we might do about shared
They might take that a bit personally, might they? If we're telling them you've got to close all your power stations.
Things stand, Tony, the Russians and the Chinese are bought into the idea of climate change. And one of the things that does make me think that it probably is happening is that there's a rush for scramble for the Arctic going on, because there's lots and lots of materials up there, including oil and gas
and ice,
but the ice is melting. The Chinese and the Russians are talking about having a container fleet bringing goods to Europe round the north of Russia.
I don't think that's because of climate change. I don't think there's anybody sensible who says there's no climate change going on at all. The question is the cause. My reply to that is, it's surely got to be much more to do with the Chinese Communist Party than it has to do with Boris or Ian. Do you think that this is going to be an issue, this whole zero carbon business, when it comes to choosing a leader for the Tories?
No, I don't think it is. I think the actual members of the party will go for the person that they think represents them correctly. They're not that concerned. The average member is more worried about the cost of electricity and survival.
Well, Rishi Sunak wants to have these green taxes, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Rishi Sunak, to some extent, has been against Boris from day one. His policies have racked up the debts of this country. You're effectively bribing the public, in my view, and Boris paid the price. If you look at what was going on, he had put in place domain names a year earlier. He was planning like mad. So this was Boris, who, a nice guy, very good at selling what he did, really persuaded a lot of Labour voters to go for Conservatives, helped with the scare of the Brexit Party, failed to capitalise on it. But the point is, the average person in the street is actually paying the price.
So who's going to win, do you think?
I don't really care, quite
frankly.
No,
come on. No, I want you to give us a steer. What do you think?
I don't think we want more of the Chancellor we had. I think the country needs to look at reducing taxes. It's a gamble to get the economy going. And then we can start to deal with what is a balance of trade payments that is terrifying, in my view.
Well, so you're talking about Liz Truss, woman that... Martin, what was it you were saying just before we sat down about Liz this week? She made a little bit of a gaffe.
Well, yes, yeah, when she passed the... When she, obviously, she came second in the ballot, she then put on a Twitter account, "I intend to hit the ground from day one." And, of course, what she meant to say was hit the ground running from day one. She then took the tweet down, but, of course, it's out there. And in fact, not untypical of the kind of gaffe that she comes out with.
She mixed up the Black Sea with the Baltic, didn't she? Yes. Which is a very terrible mistake, really, for a foreign secretary to make.
Possibly, but more the policies they put in place are really important. If you start criticising somebody for mistakes, you're losing the...
But does she have a personality? This is also quite important.
I think she does.
Really?
I think she's come through. She's shown herself as she's campaigning. She's got the support of the party behind her. Okay, it's to the right of the party. But she's doing what she needs to do.
Well, she can read a script anyway. Let's have a listen to a little clip from... the thing is, how... this is, I think, very important for a politician. Can they talk off the cuff or not? And I don't think Liz is very good at that. But anyway, we'll see how it all goes after the summer break, after the silly season of the journalists' holidays and the politicians' holidays and everything being fixed up behind the scenes, folks, in this lovely democracy of ours. Let's have a listen to a bit of Boris at his last Prime Minister's questions.
I want to use the last few seconds, Mr. Speaker, to give some words of advice to my successor, whoever he or she may be. Number one, stay close to the Americans, stick up for the Ukrainians, stick up for freedom and democracy everywhere. Cut taxes and deregulate wherever you can to make this the greatest place to live and invest, which it is. I love the Treasury, but remember that if we'd always listened to the Treasury, we wouldn't have built the M25 or the Channel Tunnel. Focus on the road ahead. Focus on the road ahead, but always remember to check the rear view mirror. And remember above all, it's not Twitter that counts. It's the people that sent us here. And yes, sir, the last few years have been the greatest privilege of my life. And it's true that I helped to get the biggest Tory majority for 40 years and a huge realignment in UK politics, Mr. Speaker. We've transformed our democracy and restored our national independence, as my right honourable friend says. I've helped to get this country through a pandemic and help save another country from barbarism. And frankly, that's enough to be going on with. Mission largely accomplished. For now, I want to thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to thank all the wonderful staff of the House of Commons. I want to thank all my friends and colleagues. I want to thank my right-hand friend opposite, Mr. Speaker. I want to thank everybody here, and hasta la vista, baby. Thank you.
So that's Boris at the end of Prime Minister's questions this week, Ian. What do you make of that?
I think it was very good. I think in reality he was saying to the public, this is what I wanted to do, I couldn't do it. And I knew what was going on behind the scenes, and I just couldn't get to grips with it.
Hasta la vista, does he mean that? Is he going to be back?
In American history, there are a couple of presidents who've come back after losing, so it's not impossible.
Does he have a political future, Martin, or is he just going to be like Blair and don't go a load of speeches and make a load of money now?
I think he's intending to be a backbench troublemaker. That's probably what he's going to do.
Well, he could be quite good at that, couldn't he?
Well, Ted Heath tried that.
Yes, that's right. But of course, obviously, I don't agree with most of what he said there. As far as I'm concerned, this has been a disastrous passage in my lifetime since 1979.
Is it going to be good for the Labour Party? If Liz Truss takes over from Boris, do you think that's going to be good for Labour? Because, I mean, looking at Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, I mean, he's one of those people that doesn't seem to sort of have much of a personality. And in order to win, he's got to have somebody else like Liz Truss rather than Boris that has little charisma, should we say.
Well, I don't know is the answer to that, but I think the party, the Conservative Party moving to the right is a political error, which they will regret. You can't cut taxes when we've got the biggest deficit that we've had since the Second World War, not just as a result of the pandemic, but as a result of the banking collapse of 2008, which we've never discussed because we spent too much time talking about Brexit and, of course, on the left talking about climate change. We just haven't focused on the important stuff. And when he said there, we've got to stick close to the Americans, fight with the Ukrainians, you just see, it's the charge of the Light Brigade. We're going to the Crimea, are we? That is not doing anything for ordinary people in this country. But the cost of living crisis is rooted in the banking crisis of 2008, the financial deregulation of the markets in 1980. The war on terror was because we funded the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s with heroin. Was one of the major sources of their funding. And the other thing, of course, is the privatisation of public utilities, when we used to have some sovereignty over things like oil, gas, And another big, can I say,
I understand where you're coming from in terms of the Labour Party, but I think it's missing the point. I talk to a lot of people in Manchester, I'm there most of the week, who are really suffering. They're really basic Labour supporters, and what they care about is education of their children, which is terrible in Manchester. They want to know they've got money so they can feed themselves. They want a job. They want a national health system that works. And the more Labour pushes to the marginal areas, I understand why you're looking at zero carbon and things like that.
I'm not a big fan of that.
No, but I say Labour's got to reconnect with those voters. There's no question. And until they start asking and giving the policies to solve that, they're not going to get the support.
Well, you'll find on the left of the party, there are people saying, well, he's got to put some meat on the bones.
I agree.
Yeah. And, of course, what happened at the last election, we had a massive manifesto full of all sorts of meat, but it wasn't actually digestible by anybody.
But with the last election, you were aligning with the Scottish, so it scared the hell out of the Tories. It certainly made a lot of people vote Conservative because they were scared.
Martin, Ian here has put his 50 pence on Liz Truss. Is that right? Martin, I think she's going to win
because of the nature of the electorate.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, this is 180,000 Conservative diehards. And they ought to choose Rishi Sunak. And this is only since Haig brought in this internal elections in the Conservative Party. In the past, the Parliamentary Party would have chosen Rishi Sunak, and that would have been that. And Rishi Sunak is a Thatcherite, but he doesn't believe in cutting taxes now. I don't believe in cutting taxes. We should cut national insurance straight away. That should never have been done. We've actually got to back to the 1950s, where we had proper wealth and inheritance taxes, and the top rate of income tax in this country was 95%, and in the United States of America was 96%, and the economy boomed.
But a lot of very clever people with a lot of money that were running the country left. A lot of actors went into France, into Switzerland. You know, we lost so much skill the country needed. Well, if you tax people too much, they just stop working.
Well,
that's the point.
What you do is you actually say, if you leave the country and say you're living in France or Belize, like John Ashcroft, the head of the Tory party, then you will live in Belize. And you will lose your right of residence in this country.
What about Rishi Sunak's wife?
Don't forget that everything in the country, the physical infrastructure, the farmland, that can't be moved. Well,
isn't this all come down to the dreadful mistake Mrs. Thatcher made of getting rid of exchange control?
That's right.
So if you can move your money all over the world, you're going to move it away from the taxman, aren't you?
That's right. And in 1979, you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country without permission. And that was normal around the world. And people think, we can't go back to that. The Russians have just gone back to it.
But those
you can't take your money out of Russia without permission from the government.
When Margaret Thatcher removed a lot of the restrictions for banking and for trade around the world, it boomed the entire economy around the world. We benefited. What we didn't do was then redistribute appropriately the money that needed.
I mean, isn't that a bit like a sugar high? You know, you're getting very excited for a few years or whatever, but then all of a sudden your chickens come home to roost.
We're never going to agree about this. Because the Thatcher era, I was alive in that era.
So was I.
When she resigned, we were going up and down Whitehall in a little red mini, tooting the horn and playing Stand Down Margaret. Well, mind you, she had already stood down.
The point is about on the economic side, the Thatcherite experiment, which is what it is, has basically failed in every department. We haven't got enough hours to go through why it was wrong, everything that they did. The previous management of the economy from 1945 to 1970s was superior. And when the banking system collapsed in 2008, it was quite clear that the monetarist model of the economy was simply wrong.
But that didn't
George Osborne lost the country's AAA credit rating.
But if it was such a great period, the IMF bailed out this country. We had a
The IMF were called in because the Americans were tripping up our Labour government. Harold Wilson was pushed out by MI5, which is the Americans, which is, of course, you've got Boris Johnson saying we've got to stick close to the Americans.
But
who runs this country? It isn't Brussels. Wall Street and Washington, isn't it?
Or both.
Harold Wilson was a very sharp politician, knew exactly what he's doing, got out at the right time, left somebody else to take the can. Mm. The country at the time had a real problem because after the Second World War, we didn't have the funds to re-engineer the country. Germany was given a free card to do that. We needed to spend a lot of money to catch up. Margaret Thatcher did a lot to change the country. Right or wrong, some of the things are wrong.
A lot to change the country, but all of it wrong, in my view.
But the fundamental problem is you cannot run a country and borrowing and borrowing and borrowing because there comes a day you've got to pay.
That's why you've got to raise taxes. And that's exactly in the Korean War, we fought the Battle of the Imjin River in North Korea, which we'd invaded, and we still had money to pay for a health service because the top rate of tax is 95%.
How can you raise taxes from people who've got their money squirreled away in tax havens?
Well, it's not the easiest thing to do.
It's all very well for you to say, yeah, we've got to raise taxes. How are you going to get your hands on this money?
Okay, well, can we try one thing? Any business trades in this country from overseas, you go a gross tax, not a net, so they can't have all deductions. So if you look at the money that's going out from Amazon and from Apple overseas, you say, let's take 10-20%, you've still got a hell of a lot more tax than they're paying. That then puts you in confrontation with America, but you then have to deal with your own tax havens. We've got a lot of them.
That's right. So in other words, Britain is in a strong position to take a lead on this.
Well,
yes, because you could say, well, we're running all these.
Well, if we're in charge of that tax haven, yeah, maybe we can just seize that.
I mean,
that.
The people in
seize that cash.
Yes, we can send the Royal
maybe,
Navy.
Maybe say to them, sorry, there's only 1% of your money that's in that tax haven is left. Mind you, of course, a lot of it in Switzerland. We can't do anything about that. So, anyway, look, we've been talking enough about the Conservative Party. I think we've got Martin, which, did you say, Rishi? You think Liz is going to be going to win,
because of the nature of the electorate. She's going to win.
Okay. Totally, so we've got that straight.
I totally agree with that one.
For the next for a month or so's time. Yeah. Let's have a look at the Labour Party, because we've had the Ford report out this week, which is all about the Labour Party's own internal wrangling to try and kill off Jeremy Corbyn whilst he was their leader. And here is Danny Finkelstein, who's called Lord Finkelstein now, who's Conservative, on the BBC Politics Live earlier this week, the day that the Ford report came out, I think Wednesday.
What this report shows is so much more than just factionalism. You know, what Martin Ford QC has found is that a right-wing faction at the very top of Labour HQ, rather than respect the democratic mandate, the two democratic mandates that Jeremy Corbyn got in 2015 and 2016 on a platform of anti-austerity, of public ownership of our services and utilities, rather than accept that, they set about trying to burn down the house. And some of the findings in this report are absolutely scandalous. You know, diverting funds away from winnable target seats in the 2017 election to allies within their own faction, for example, or examples, and we've all seen the WhatsApp messages, examples of overt anti-black racism directed towards some of our most senior MPs. You know, some of the findings in this are absolutely repugnant, and it is incumbent on the leader of the Labour Party now, Keir Starmer, to take firm and affirmative action and not just shelve this and let it gather dust like it has been for the last 2 years.
That's the Momentum left-wing activist, pro-Corbyn activist Martin Abrahams talking. We'll be hearing from Danny Finkelstein in a minute. Martin, this does sound like a horrific operation going on within the Labour Party. They're supposed to be fighting the Tories. They're not. They're fighting Jeremy Corbyn, their own leader.
Well, the Labour Party, because of its nature, have got one foot in the establishment and one foot outside. It's the nature of the beast. And it's always been a struggle by the activists, and of course there were more of them at that time because the Labour Party recruited lots of younger people.
Jeremy Corbyn recruited people.
Yeah, and of course that put the finances of the party on a relatively good footing. What actually happened when Keir Starmer took over is various staff members who were actually probably at the heart of what's went on in this in the allegations in the Ford report. They accused the party of institutional anti-Semitism towards them, and they were going to take the party to court. And the lawyers of the party had concluded that they would not win in court, that they wouldn't win. Just as David Miller, internal inquiry at Bristol University showed that there was no anti-Semitism. But instead of going to court, he paid them off, and he paid them off several million pounds. And as somebody who's paid subs to the Labour Party every week since 1975, I resent that. And, of course, the finances of the party are now messed up because of that payment to these people who would have lost in court. And that's because the pro-Palestinian position of Corbyn was hated by the Israelis and the Americans, and they put their finger into our politics. Al Jazeera did a sting operation, did they not?
Oh, that's right. They had the political attaché at the Israeli embassy. Shai Massot saying, I've got a million quid.
Yes, talking to a Labour MP who subsequently resigned because she said couldn't work with Corbyn, said, I've got a million quid to spend here to make the Labour Party do what we want. And it was all there on the record. Now, that is in international politics plays a part in Labour internal politics because of the nature of the international movement which we're a part of.
But doesn't that show the weakness of British politicians? They should have refused to accept the money quite clearly.
Well, she was prepared to accept it in order to try and leverage things inside the Labour Party, and that's what that she should have been sacked.
It wasn't actually just against the Labour Party, wasn't it? It was there was also I can't remember the name of the guy. He was Defence Minister at the time.
That's right, Alan Duncan.
They were trying to get rid of him too. So this Israeli interference in British politics is a bit worrying.
I'm not concerned about that because you can legislate for it, you've got your secret services, you control it. I just think politicians need to be open. If they get a large offer of money, go to the public, say, should I accept it, rather than trying to do deals.
Yeah,
I'm not involved in the Labour Party, I have to say.
No.
I'm watching them in fascination because in the same way as Boris managed to lose a fantastic majority.
It's all very convenient for the Tories, Martin, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. I mean, basically, if you're trying to change society as a radical member of the Labour Party, which is what I probably describe myself as, it's an uphill struggle. I mean, Nye Bevan years ago was asked, well, what's a revolution? He said, well, you've got the media, the police, the army, the secret services, they're all pressing down on us. What a revolution is, and he was doing it with his fingers, that's a revolution. And what you've got to do, you've got to fight against all of those institutions. It's a huge struggle. It's a generational struggle. And we're going to change society, but it's going to be a huge fight, like in South Africa, like anywhere.
But isn't it about persuading the voters that you have the right answer?
Well, you've got to carry people right. with you. If you're just talking to yourselves, then you're wasting your time.
Yeah, the problem for Labour is they come across as dictating and demanding and authorising things that people say, oh, I don't want to be living like that. I want the freedom.
It depends how many people identify with your vision.
You know,
it would
be nice to have actually a clip of Mick Lynch. I think maybe we should do that almost every week because he seems to represent working people in the speeches he makes, the policies he talks about, the whole idea of having proper national public sector pay settlements where everybody,
as they do in Scandinavia,
as they do in sensible countries, and they used to do here. Actually, what I'm afraid, Keir Starmer, who you voted for, he shies away from all this, doesn't he? I don't want to be seen to be supporting the rail strike.
The problem for the Labour leadership in the first past the post system that we have is that they have to win over swing.
But they also have to have the courage, don't they, to stick their neck out sometimes. Like
Jeremy
Corbyn did.
Yes, but at the same time, you don't want to lose. And that's why Starmer is... I'm just trying to explain. I'm not really a supporter of Starmer. I'd be much more on Mick Lynch's side. But I'm just trying to explain it from his point of view. He feels that he mustn't be seen to be... I mean, the RMT, I don't think, are even affiliated to the Labour Party anymore.
Anyway, Danny
so
Finkelstein...
he doesn't want to be seen to be too... pro striker.
On the Politics Live show, Danny Finkelstein was saying he was explaining why he thinks the Labour right wing were fighting Corbyn, and I mean obviously as a Tory he's patting them all on the back.
The reason the right was in the party were fighting you was two reasons. One is because it was completely obvious that there was a large strand of anti-Semitism on the left in the party that was appropriately being fought. And I feel that Martin Ford in his report doesn't sufficiently acknowledge that. I understand he wasn't asked to, and I'm not blaming him for that. He was asked to give a review of the facts. But nevertheless, it was appropriate to use anti-Semitism as part of the argument to the left because it arose out of their political doctrine and it needs to be tackled. And secondly, because it was obvious he was going to take the party to massive electoral defeat. So the factional resistance to him by party officials was completely appropriate. I think this does suggest that it existed, but I'm glad that it did because he has obviously his experience as Jews and not all Jews feel exactly the same. But I think the mainstream of the community felt very vulnerable to Jeremy Corbyn's ideology, and I think that most of them will read it and think it's good that there was a faction in the Labour Party, which now appears to have gained the upper hand, which Thangan correctly suggested, which was resisting that. So I was pleased to read it.
Can I just add that also the equality, we have to take account of the
this
fact
is
that
the Labour
MP, Commission,
Rushnara Ali,
found the Labour Party wanting on anti-Semitism, and there's a programme of action that Keir Starmer, under his leadership, has taken because there is a necessary need for particular focus on that issue, but that doesn't mean that there should be or is a hierarchy of equalities. And of course, as a Muslim, as someone of colour, I'm absolutely determined, along with all my colleagues, to make sure that every member and every individual that's in our movement is properly supported and treated with respect. And we will continue to do that piece of work.
Martin, quickly to you in response to what Danny was saying.
Well, I'd just like to say it's not delusional. You know, united parties win elections, and when you've got some of the most senior members of Labour headquarters, you know, working against you, essentially conspiring on these, you know, these WhatsApp groups. And like I said, we've all seen the messages. So for Danny to say that's delusional, it's not. A united party wins elections. These people should have respected the democratic mandate, and things could have been very, very different. In terms of what Rushanara's just said, you know, there is a hierarchy of racism, I'm afraid to say. We read the response from the Labour Muslim Network to this report. You know, there is serious issues that Labour need to get a grip of. And, you know, Keir Starmer, before he was elected as leader, he stood on a platform of uniting our party, and he simply has not done that. And there's still so much work to do. What he did instead was essentially throw a hand grenade into the party. He removed the whip from Jeremy Corbyn. He then reneged on his promise to move from top-down selections of MPs. Factionalism still exists.
This hierarchy of racism, can you just explain to me what you mean by that? Are you suggesting that you think that anti-Semitism got too much attention paid to it?
What I mean by
Take us through the hierarchy, though. Who comes at the top and who comes at the bottom? Because if there's a hierarchy, if you know there's a hierarchy, presumably you know what the order is. So take us through what you meant by that.
Well, Danny, listen, I'm listening to people that are clearly having lived experiences within the Labour Party. You know, you should probably read the response from the Labour Muslim Network that feel they have been serially let down by the Labour Party over many years. You know, all racism should be treated equally and should be treated.
So you're suggesting that Jews are being given preferential treatment by Keir Starmer's anti-racism drive? Is that what you're suggesting?
Listen, I'm here today to speak on this report and say that there is serious work for the Labour Party to do to stamp out racism in the party, and this report shines a very, very strong light on that when some of the most senior members of the Labour headquarters, you know, are sending repugnant WhatsApp messages about some of our most senior black MPs.
Martin, what is this hierarchy of racism? He really doesn't want to answer that question, does he? Any ideas?
Well, let's not beat about the bush. The organised Jewish community is very pro-Israel, and the wealthier part of it is very strongly conservative. They don't represent all Jews in this country. The Jewish Voice for Labour people...
Danny Finkelstein, of course, is Jewish.
Yes, that's right, and he's a conservative peer, as many conservative Jews are conservatives. Not all Jews are conservatives. Of course they aren't. And not all Jews are that wealthy. Naomi Wimborne Idrisi, who is a Jewish doctor, she set up Jewish Voice for Labour as a result of all of this antagonism towards Jeremy Corbyn. She has been suspended from the Labour Party, as have many Jewish members, for anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I think I'm right in saying that actually most of the individuals in the Labour Party who've been suspended for anti-Semitism are Jewish.
That's
Which
right. What they are is left-wing Jews opposed to Israeli policy. Mm. And that is why they've been persecuted. Now, being a member of the Labour Party is a bit like being a member of the Polish United Workers' Party in Poland before the changes. What you've got is, if you want to change society, you've got to work through the Labour Party because there isn't any other option under the electoral system. But that means it's also a top-down management run. The secret services are in control of key parts of it and so on. So in actual fact, you're then forced to get to go uphill to deal with these kind of problems.
Isn't it the case, though, that the Labour Party is just managing to make the Conservatives look even better, as it argues what it should be doing is getting its act together, focusing on the next election, giving the voters what they want to hear? I totally understand parties argue and fight, and the Conservatives ripped themselves to pieces in the past and probably about to do it again, but the voters actually want to know how they're going to be better off. If the Conservatives and the Labour just... focus on that, it might be a different result.
I think that obviously the trick is, like, it's quite simple to play football. You've just got to kick the ball down the thing and then kick it through the post. But in actual fact, teams, some are good, some are bad.
Big difference here is that you've got the Conservatives fighting mid-term. The Labour Party are at each other's throats in the run-up to a general election, then lost. And one of those factions was cheering, very happy that Jeremy Corbyn was lost, which is just no way to behave.
That's because they're on the side of the establishment. If it was a different electoral system, we'd be in two different parties.
I'm going to replay a little clip.
Wasn't that the problem? The party should have split at that point.
Yeah, but if you split in a first-past-the-post setup, you can see what the problems would be. If the Brexit Party had stood at the last election, you would probably have had sufficient votes to let us in. And of course, you made the correct decision from your own point of view not to stand.
Well, no, I stood, and the seats where Brexit did stand, the percentage vote we took was pretty well the swing that went to the Tories that gave them the seats. So you can argue we actually gave the Tories the seats in most of the places we stood.
Yeah, well, presumably you're only standing in the really hardcore areas where it's not going to tip it one way or the
other. I stood in Wrexham that had such a strong Labour MP that had never had Conservative, and the swing was phenomenal. When I spoke to some of the miners who'd been hard Labour 40, 50 years, they said, we can't support Labour, we're going to vote Conservative.
Yep. Anyway, Danny Finkelstein just then was speaking, and we're going to hear what he had to say. We're going to replay it, actually. And it's where he calls Rushnara Ali, who's the Labour MP of colour sitting next to him. He actually calls her Thangam, which is our Bristol West MP, Thangam Debonair. She gives her the wrong name. Have a listen to this.
The mainstream of the community felt very vulnerable to Jeremy Corbyn's ideology, and I think that most of them will read it and think it's good that there was a faction in the Labour Party, which now appears to have gained the upper hand, which Thangam correctly suggested, which was resisting that, so I was pleased to read it.
So there he is, calling Rushnara Thangam. I'm not sure if it's possible for Danny to, as a Tory, to distinguish between these two ethnic minority MPs. But anyway, Danny Finkelstein, here it is. Where I'm going to play you the little bit of the interview where Rushnara actually picks him up, saying, "Well, actually, you called me the wrong name, didn't you?"
It's worthwhile acknowledging there's a section of the electorate that think the rules aren't made for me. I'm happy to have somebody who was a bit rambunctious and broke the rules, and they think he got certain things done. I think the truth is somewhere between your view that every single thing that Tories ever do is, like, absolutely terrible if only we had a Labour government.
I was talking about Partygate. Okay. Stop trying to misinterpret what I say.
You talked about Partygate and
the way that people felt when the rules were broken, when they couldn't go to funerals.
People heard you say it the first time, but you also talked about the National Health Service, right?
People heard you say things. You can't even get my name right. You called me something else.
No, I didn't.
It's ridiculous.
I did not. That's not true at all. Sorry, excuse me.
You called me Thangam earlier.
Thangam's on later.
You're quite right.
You might have done, Danny.
I do apologise.
And an apology.
There's reason is because I met Thangam earlier today. She said she was coming on.
So there's Danny Finkelstein, first of all, saying, that's not true at all. And then within about 2 seconds, he's saying, oh, yes, well, maybe I thought Thangam was coming on later. So, I mean, it doesn't go down very well when you get someone's name wrong and then on live television pretend that you didn't. So at the end of the day, Martin, the really important figure, I think, in all of this is actually Jeremy Corbyn himself. And there was a fascinating piece with him, which we're going to hear a bit from now, which is where he explained his experience, what was happening to him when he was leader of the Labour Party, and the various establishment attacks on him, as well as those attacks going on from within his own party. Even though, of course, he's been democratically elected, he's got a mandate to do the job, he's finding it almost impossible to do that job because inside and outside the party, there are some pretty powerful forces trying to undermine him in our wonderful democracy.
I was obviously aware of the articles, and we had a daily press briefing from our office which summarised all the articles that were important to us. And I also noticed that it was particularly the Daily Telegraph that often carried leading stories, apparently from sources in the intelligence services, which I was attacked or undermined from. And when that story came out shortly after I was elected leader in 2015, from apparently a serving military officer, we obviously challenged it straight away. And they said it was a rogue element, they didn't speak for anybody else, etc., etc., etc. But I thought it was a sort of shot across the bow as a warning to me, saying, look, you might have a different view of the world. When I'd laid out an international strategy based on peace, based on human rights, based on democracy, based on fair trade, rather than the very pro-American defense and foreign policy we'd adopted. So I knew this was going to lead to attacks, and it certainly did. It also served as a warning to a lot of our supporters just what we were up against in challenging the foreign policy establishment and the up till then cosy agreement between both front benches in Parliament to support the same foreign policy. So, yes, was I shocked? Yes. Was I surprised? No. And I tell you what went through my mind was Harry Perkins in The Great British Coup.
And just to ask specifically about MI5 and MI6 as well, because there were two. There was a meeting with each institution that you had, and both were leaked. Yeah. The evidence about the meetings was leaked to the press. Can you talk about those meetings and talk about the leaks? And did you feel that those two institutions were also trying to undermine your leadership of the Labour Party?
I've had some issues with them in the past on, for example, the spy cops inquiry that's going on at the moment. A number of MPs were clearly under police surveillance through the 70s and 80s. I wasn't an MP in the 70s, but I was clearly under some form of surveillance throughout that time. The spy cops inquiry is still going on. Peter Hain was labelled as well because of his activities in the anti-apartheid movement and others. And at one stage, I was offered my police file if I accepted it in its redacted or limited form. They said, you can have all the information that we think you should have, but you've got to accept that's all you're going to get if you receive the form, the file.
When was this?
This would be long before I became leader. Right. This was when the issue came up of the surveillance that MPs had been put under. I refused. I said, I want the whole file or nothing. I'm not prepared to accept your idea that you can edit out what information you've got on me. And the spy cops inquiry is still going on, and I have a volunteer legal representative at the inquiry on my behalf who's following everything. And that's the policing. That's the police spy cops inquiry, which is... Is it the same as MI5 / MI6? Not exactly, but there's clearly a link within it. On the meetings we had, they were obviously private meetings. We obviously prepared for them and went there. We absolutely did not inform or leak about the meeting at all to anybody. And I instructed my office that this meeting had to be treated as completely confidential, and it was. It was leaked by them. And it was leaked in a way to undermine that somehow or other I'd been summoned and given a dressing down. That was not the nature of the meeting at all. The meeting was a discussion in which they discussed various parts of the world and various issues, none of which was new to me, none of which was a surprise to me. It was about the role of ISIS, it was about the war in Syria, it was about post-Iraq war, Afghanistan and so on. They were well aware of my views on those conflicts and very well aware of what I'd said and acted about it at the time. They acknowledged I had a different view from themselves and the government. And the meetings were, yeah, they were pretty frank. Were they aggressive? No. It was an intelligent discussion. Obviously, it was all recorded. Obviously, it was all then leaked out as a way to be deliberately undermining of me.
That's Jeremy Corbyn talking about the way that MI5 and MI6, the security services, didn't just have articles in the Daily Telegraph saying that he wasn't fit to be leader or that he could potentially be deposed if he got close to being leader. There's also a situation there, Martin, where you've got security services basically just luring him in for a little chit-chat and then deliberately leaking it to the press.
Yeah. And, of course, there's the Integrity Initiative, which is, again, front for MI6. They were tweeting anti-Corbyn tweets into the blogosphere.
Yeah, paid by MI6.
At taxpayer expense. And, of course, you have the general, whoever he was, who was never identified, saying Corbyn will never be allowed to be the Prime Minister because we will remove it. People think they live in a democracy, but people in Argentina know very well that MI6 were behind the military dictatorship in Argentina. They know very well around the world that MI6 has been deeply involved in terrorism in Syria, including the sponsorship of the White Helmets, supposedly humanitarian organisation, which is embedded with Jabhat al-Nusra and various other pro-Salafi outfits. Nothing in that surprises me. It's always going to be a struggle. And at some point, we will elect a radical government, and then we will probably deal with the American, reaction.
With these sorts of tactics inside and outside the Labour Party, did Jeremy Corbyn stand a chance?
Well, it's obviously going to be an uphill struggle. What he should have done, in my view, Tony, and I can see you're trying to get it. What he should have done is when he was standing for leadership of the party, and I've said this, I went to a meeting where he was still standing for the leadership of the party. I got the first question and said, will you commit to PR like the New Zealand Labour Party did in the 1980s? Because if you do that, then your radical faction of the Labour Party becomes a core of a wider progressive coalition, and we change the constitution of the country, move forward.
Yeah, well, there is another, maybe simpler way, and that is for him to have treated his friends better than his enemies in his own party. If he'd have had for example, as Thangam Debonair, our local MP here, had some sort of meeting where she was actually out there openly criticising her own leader, I mean, surely that's a disciplinary offence and she should be out of the party.
No.
She shouldn't be able to stand again as a Labour MP if she's going to start having a go at her leader as part of this kind of right-wing faction that's trying to get rid of him.
What we could have done, and we were it was discussed, is that we should have automatic reselection of all Labour MPs.
No. That would have been really good,
but
it never happened.
Was discussed. And the reason it didn't happen is because it was the approach taken was that would be very divisive.
We will end up
having loads of rows about
Martin,
it.
We're seeing a lot more top-down going on, both in the Tory party and in the Labour party. I noticed with this leadership campaign over the summer, with the Conservatives, all the local constituency parties have been instructed that they're not to allow any meetings with either of the two candidates to happen within their constituencies. That it's basically all got to be run by the TV people. A similar sort of thing seems to have been going on within the Labour Party, and we're going to hear in a minute from Debbie Hicks. But before we do that, just your reaction to what, you know, this Jeremy Corbyn there talking about how he's, yeah, being basically manoeuvred by the military into a position where they've clearly decided that they don't want him anywhere near power.
In terms of that period, Corbyn clearly knew what he was facing and probably didn't take the right steps to protect himself. I think I can say for the Labour Party, he brought in a lot more members, opened it up as a party, reduced the fees they were paying. What he wasn't doing was selling a dream to the public. Mm. And he faced a leader who was very good at doing it on the opposition.
He was very good, and this is something that Starmer, I'm afraid, you know, maybe collect a handful of people, but Jeremy Corbyn was able to collect audiences of thousands. It was almost like a rock star comes to town.
No question. From all the research I did of him, if he'd have carried on and been that person, he could have made a difference. But his policies at the last election was his letdown.
Anyway, Debbie Hicks, she was in Bristol's Castle Park last weekend, and on Saturday, Keep It Cash is her campaign. She doesn't like electronic money, and we're going to be hearing from her in a minute. But first, I asked her about this Jeremy Corbyn being undermined, because she was a Labour Party member in Gloucestershire at the time.
I think we all knew that at the time, didn't we, when he was leader of the Labour Party, that he was being undermined from every level, actually. I don't think it just happened at the top of the party. I think I could see that at a local level where I was active. All sorts of people that were doing their best to undermine the if I could call it, the Corbyn project. There was a lot of people who should actually know that joined the party at that time, record numbers actually, I think, if I remember, because they wanted to see Jeremy Corbyn become the Prime Minister, and they wanted to do everything to make that happen. And I was one of those people as well. I wanted to see that happen. But of course, all the newbies, if I can call it out, all this new blood that came in, that, and they were amazing people, were pushed to the sidelines. I watched it happen in my local constituency, Labour Party. I watched that happen. There's a mixture of reasons. I don't think it was just anti-Corbyn. I think there is a culture that's developed in the Labour movement over decades of control and of fear of change. And I think that was a lot of it as well. It wasn't just Jeremy Corbyn. I think it was this fear of change in the Labour Party, because, of course, there was a process of democratisation that was happening. That's what these new members were demanding. They wanted to say, they wanted to be active. So,
well, it's not just the Labour members, is it? I think, you know, many of the voters want that change too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think, as I said, I think it was happening on both levels, grassroots and from the top. And yeah, that's what we were all up against.
Well, you're no longer a Labour Party member, are you?
No.
So what did you see to, you know, as someone who was active within the party, to make you think, look, I've had enough here?
Yeah, I resigned in 2017. Just after the general election. That was the first one that Corbyn fought, wasn't it? The 2017 one.
Yes, and he did very well.
He did do very well. It was very close, actually. I think it was a handful of votes, wasn't it? And he could have become Prime Minister. But I resigned, nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn or anything to do with that. I resigned because of what I've just talked about, this local culture of control, complete control, actually very tyrannical control over members, over activists, over people that wanted to, and I was one of those people, I really wanted to democratize the local party and get people involved, and I just kept getting a brick wall. And not only that, there was it's politics, sadly, and it's the way it shouldn't be and it has to change, but there was too much ego and competition between people about who was going to be in control, and I found it quite sinister, and I didn't want to be involved any longer.
Yeah, similar things have been going on here in Bristol, Martin, haven't they, with the Central Labour Party actually removing members of the constituency Labour Party here and just, you know, basically taking them under control from the top.
Yeah, there's been a big exodus of members, particularly younger members who joined during that era. And of course that is playing out in the way in which the Greens are eating into the Labour vote in the inner cities. They've made that leap from
Bristol,
being a middle class party. Yeah.
Anyway, Debbie, you just heard there, as I said, she was in Castle Park last Saturday talking about the lockdowns. Not just the lockdowns, but actually her main thing is about cash. She has now decided that going cashless is a really bad idea. And I asked her why.
When you put all together what's happened over the last 2 years with lockdowns, with the you know, the restrictions that came in around COVID and all the rest of it, it to me was all a build up and a sort of process of normalization, getting people used to a system of digital and tyrannical control. Because obviously, I mean, there were so many things, wasn't there? I mean, we could that's a whole other conversation, but just an example that I talked about on Saturday was a lot of the restrictions were about where you could walk in shops, in public spaces, sort of controls in terms of getting people ready for a kind of a social credit system, a system of debits and credits according to our behaviour, our lifestyle and what we do, and simple things like where you walk down the street is something that they do that in China. Citizens have to walk in certain places because obviously it's all linked to technology and cameras. So these, you know, all these controls with lockdown were about priming people, I think, for this new economy, this new digital, complete digital economy that's kicking in. And of course, what's going to go with that is going to be a digital currency. And to me, cashless, which is what that equals digital tyranny. It's going to be complete control of our lives in every way. because to have a digital currency, they need to use us as data.
Yes, this is almost like Google, isn't it, Ian? I mean, you know, we're now talked about as commodities, the things we think are a commodity, which they can then sell to an advertiser.
Totally agree. I mean, having said that, Big Brother Watch this week flagged up the Metropolitan Police trying out facial recognition. That goes hand in hand with controlling the people, controlling their bank accounts. I think what people are missing is take away cash. A lot of older people do not have the credit cards, do not have the online facility. They need the cash. They've tried it, I think, in Denmark and places like that. And what I've read is individuals trying to pay for something with cash can't do it. You are setting up a two-stage system. For me, it's great. I can use the internet. I can do all that trading. But for a lot of people, they can't. I would be really upset if we go to a cashless society in the same way as I'm totally opposed to facial recognition, which is the big issue at the moment. Add all the bits together. We're going down the road of total control. If you don't pay your tax, we cut you off. If you do this, we cut you off. I think it's a freedom issue.
Martin, we've had some, well, I'd say very bad news in the end of June from China, because the Chinese authorities have been using these COVID health passes to prevent protests. Stark warning for the rest of the world as to how governments can and will use health applications to block civil liberties and human rights if authorities deem it unfavourable. So there's some sort of a protest over in China, and what happens is, in order to stop people gathering, the Chinese government just switches off their health pass, so they're now considered to be diseased or something, so they can't come into the city. Now, this is, you know, it's a very authoritarian way to stop protests, isn't it? Well, at least we don't have that here yet.
I don't know, the latest the Conservatives put through has pretty well put a lot of problems on protests. Well, if it's too loud, they can pick you up for it.
Yeah.
It's getting towards control.
There is a certain a nervousness about the... I mean, we had Kees van der Peel on this show a few months ago saying, well, the elite, as they take control in their fascistic fashion, they know there's going to be pushback, and so they have to make sure that there are ways to control the population to take away those civil liberties. Anyway, what do you make of this report from China, Martin? China's provided a stark example the extent to which governments will abuse power that comes with these COVID-19 smartphone applications, as authorities in Henan province turned the health status of citizens red in order to prevent a scheduled bank protest. This was all to do with the collapse of a bank in Henan, where something like $175 million of deposits was frozen by the bank because they'd gone bust of the people in the town. And in order to prevent the protest, the health pass has just been switched off by the Communist Party.
Well, we started off by talking about cashless society, and then we moved on to a more general critique of surveillance as conducted by people in China and elsewhere. Just on the cashless society, Narendra Modi in India tried to bring in banning of large cash banknotes at the prompting of the USAID, which is basically a front for the CIA, and they tried to bring it in. And of course, in a country like India, perhaps half the population haven't got a bank account, so this was a really silly thing to do. It caused all kinds of problems, especially for small businesses, you know, tea sellers and people like that, and eventually they had to withdraw it. And it did cause problems for Modi politically.
Well, we are going to be talking a bit more about the cashless in a minute, but what about this specific things? They are putting digital handcuffs on us, one depositor from Sichuan province told Reuters. In China, since the introduction of the COVID-19 health app, anyone without a green card code on their app is blocked from all public transport and public spaces.
Well, I mean, this is the nature of what goes on in China. I mean, don't forget, in this country, anybody who's got a mobile phone, you are trackable. Not just trackable by the state. You can be trackable by private individuals. Anybody can track you. And if you want to get away from that, as the Taliban realized in Afghanistan, you don't carry any electronic equipment with you at all. You creep around in the middle of the night and whisper in people's ears.
China is leading the way, says Reuters, when it comes to digital authoritarianism, exemplified by the social credit score system, which has been in effect since 2017, whereby citizens can be blocked from a variety of public services for demonstrating what they call bad behaviour decided by the police and the government. Essentially, those who criticise the government or held views deemed undesirable by the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, they've got a pretty similar setup in Singapore, which isn't run by the Communist Party. It's not quite a one-party state, but it's virtually is. But of course, it's quite difficult to get into Singapore because it's a very prosperous place and people are generally quite satisfied with their lot.
It's not really, it's nowhere near as difficult to get into Singapore as it is to get into, say, Hong Kong. Now it's controlled.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there's been specific features to do with the pandemic and all the rest of it, which we've debated at great length on this show.
I think the Singapore, you know, whoever, a prime minister, would, if he were here, would say, no, no, we are not like China.
Well, actually. In actual fact, the Singaporeans are in the middle between the Chinese and the West. Being that middle, in that middle position suits them very well. And the same is true for other Southeast Asian countries. They want to do business with China, but they want to be friends with the West as well.
Let's have a little listen to a bit more from Debbie Hicks, who was here speaking in Castle Park in Bristol last Saturday about this whole business of cashless society. What I put to her was there doesn't seem to have been very much, or if any, public debate. The banks have just decided to do this. This is the way they're going to do it. And if you cannot get cash from your bank anymore, then tough.
I don't think they want people to realise what's happening. I mean, people do know what's happening. The general public that I talk to out on the streets when I'm campaigning, they're very concerned. And most people, I have to say, want to keep cash. And they can see what's happening. They see the cash points closing down. They see that they're being coerced into using their cards and their phones. And they are concerned. But as you said, the mass media, there's a complete... there's silence on this topic. I mean, last year, Tony, I don't know if you were aware, there was a campaign where quite a lot of MPs signed up to keeping cash in circulation. And some of the big shops, Marks and Spencers, Waitrose, the post office, were behind this campaign to keep cash in circulation. And what they've done, which is actually really good news, again, people don't know, is that the finance bill that's currently going through Parliament has a caveat attached to it that they have to keep cash in circulation. So that was a very quiet campaign, but it was very successful. So it's, which to me is really promising, actually, in terms of, you know, that we can keep cash, because to me it's other issues that we've got to tackle, like the biometrics, as you're talking about. I think that's where it's really going to happen, where we're forced to pay with that cash is because of the biometrics. I think that's how they're, personally, how they're going to do it. But I agree with you. There's a complete silence. We need a public debate. We're not getting it in the mass media. And that's why one of the reasons I'm out there on the streets talking to people and trying to do these rallies as well.
Yeah, so it's interesting to hear there is a little bit of debate going on in Parliament. But of course, most people, the way they think is maybe not people who you've spoken to at your rally and nearby or whatever. But it's that, well, we don't really need a public debate about this because it's so much more convenient.
Yeah. Certainly there's been a few young people I've spoken to who just, you know, don't see. I mean, quite worrying, actually, when I've actually put it to them, because I always try and ask people questions to get them thinking. When I put it to them, well, doesn't it worry that all your data can be used to track you, to control you, to bring in sanctions against you if you go against sort of rules of behaviour that the government and the banks decide for you? I said, does that not worry you? And it's quite shocking. A few of them have said, no, they're not worried. And I think, oh, you know, and this is the other thing this has highlighted to me, is that with the younger generation in particular, there is a disregard, perhaps an indifference, maybe that's the word, to the concept of basic freedom. Mm. And when I try and have a conversation with them, and like, what does freedom mean to you? You can see by the look on their face, they've never thought about it at all. And I think a lot of that is for that generation. It's never been something they have to think about. Whereas maybe for us, or maybe the generation before us, our parents' generation from World War II, they can remember what it was like for countries to lose their freedom. So I think that's a lot of it. They just haven't got a grasp on what freedom means.
I suppose in a way this push for cash, Ian, is us oldies, you know, saying, look, we want to keep our cash, and the youngsters saying, get out of the way.
Well, if your card's cut off, you've got no cash. And so I always carry £100 just in case. It's about the banks, again, saving money and making things faster and more economical. There hasn't, I agree. I think what she says is spot on, being a public debate. I tonight wanted to pay for a parking ticket, didn't have any cash on me, so I used an app. But if you're not in that habit, you're going to be stuck and you can't pay for your parking ticket here in Bristol. It's a debate we need. As simple as that.
Yeah, and Debbie goes on to talk about the biometrics that she's spotting appearing in supermarkets, something you were talking about a minute ago, Ian.
Yes.
I'm now trying to get people to look at boycotting shops that are going to start using the biometrics that we're talking about, because that's the next big thing, I think, that's going to start, that we really need to get onto. So there was a press release that went out about a month ago, actually, maybe 6 weeks ago, that the main supermarkets in the UK, Tesco's, Asda, Aldi, Lidl, you know, I think it may have even been one of Sainsbury's as well, are going to start using biometric technology for you to pay for your shopping. Now, I think there was some sort of controversy about it. And when they were approached, they said, well, we haven't actually said that, but there was lots of reports in the press. So I think they're sort of priming people now. They're getting the idea in their heads, this is how you're going to have to go shopping. And as you know, Tony, lots of those shops have already got those screens. They've had them for ages. Co-op's another one. It's supposed to be ethical, isn't it? But it's not really. Co-op's got screens when you go up to the self-service tills that are already, I'm pretty sure they're already filming people and recording people. So it's, to me, after all the research I've been doing the last 6 months, I think that's how we're going to be forced to go cashless, is we just don't have a choice. There'll still be cash. It'll be a lot harder to get hold of, but there'll still be cash. But it will be that we don't have a choice when we go shopping. And that's where the power of the consumer has to come in, and a consumer campaign. We have to say to those shops by boycotting them, we don't want your biometrics. We want to pay with cash. We want to pay with a human being behind a till.
Yeah, I suppose you can just sort of leave a pile of shopping unpaid for and walk out, can't you? That's Debbie Hicks, final clip from her, who was in Castle Park last Saturday at her Keep It Cash rally, where various other freedom campaigners were speaking. Martin, this whole idea of using biometrics, does it bother you? You know, the idea that they're kind of scanning your iris and things like that to see, oh, yes, if this is Martin, we can now take the money from his account.
Well, I can see why people are very worried about that. I understand that there are people in the Bank of England who are saying we mustn't get rid of cash, because lots of people do depend on cash.
Well, the mafia do, don't they?
Well, they do, and that was the argument that Modi used in India, that if we get rid of these big denomination notes, it's going to deal with corruption.
Prince Charles does, I think, a great big suitcases full of it, in fact.
Well, of course, and then this is the kind of propaganda that will be used to get
rid
of cash.
Well, it's not really propaganda.
It's also, I mean, the shop I shop in
Prince Eastern. Harry was using, sorry, Martin, but I was in Tetbury a few years ago with a mutual friend of ours, and we were just stood outside Tesco's, and Prince Harry turned up in a big Range Rover, and he came out, parked right on the, admittedly, I don't think he was driving, it was someone else driving, parked right on the zebra crossing, you know, as royalty do, and jumped over to the cash point there, and it must have been whirring for about 5 minutes. I've no idea how much cash came out of it, and I remember thinking to myself, what does he need all this cash for? Surely he's just got a credit card or something. Anyway, who knows, maybe it was, something perfectly legitimate. But, cash is associated, isn't it, with this, it's something that you don't want on the books, you do it by cash.
Well, I mean, and there's plenty of small businesses who still demand cash in my area. You can't pay with a card. And also, of course, there's, Errol, who runs the little Caribbean store by me, he has all the elderly West Indian people going in to buy their stuff there, and they all want to pay in cash. Hmm. And they just do.
But
and
we, that's we what all the customers know, Ian, want. Ian, the main argument here, in a way, has got to be just computer says no. So that's the main reason, isn't it?
It's black economy. Government's controlling, getting hold of money. Billions disappear. They want to tax it. Get it to...
Yeah, there are issues around black economy. I mean, obviously, for example, drug dealers do not want to be paid on a credit card. And, of course, then you've got to look at things like, well, we need to regularise this market.
But it's not just drug dealers. It's people having at-home extensions, paying cash.
Right.
Things like that isn't declared. So I guess that's the motivation of governments. The question is, do you want it?
Yeah, I think there's a trade-off with anything, any system, is there not?
Yes.
I mean, we have CCTV in public places because otherwise people might get away with beating people up.
Let's keep this real, because the big, big tax evaders, I'm talking about the Amazons of this world, don't use cash at all, do they?
Nope.
No.
And we have to find a way of correctly taxing them, which means we have to review the tax system, which is wrong, and all the benefits. I could run a...
That's a bit of a job, isn't it?
I don't know, it's a bit of a job. You just say, right, we do 10% gross on everything you sell. At the moment, if you run a multinational, you can set your company up the correct way, you don't pay tax as an individual.
Transfer pricing between countries.
Well, yeah, but the problem is, they're allowed in the British system to claim so many allowances that they can effectively expand the business, not pay any tax, and destroy the opposition. So there's nobody else to compete. There's a monopoly. Then they bleed the country dry.
Yeah, well, you need proper competition laws, don't you?
Well, you need a government that's prepared to do something about
right,
it.
Right, at the sharp end of this is this company called Walletmore. I mentioned briefly at the end of last week, and I'll put another link up to this story at thisismoney.co.uk. London-based Walletmore claims to be the first company in the world to sell contactless bank card chips that can be implanted into humans. The procedure is simple, if bloody, and leaves customers with a small stitch below the wrist. Once the chip is in, you no longer have to bother with debit or credit cards. But this story's got a great chip in the a great sting in the tail, because the firm, which has been featured both on the BBC and Forbes, has been plunged into controversy after it emerged it had misled customers. They've been repurposing chips from a third-party supplier, which is associated with MasterCard. Once they were alerted to Walletmore's actions, both companies pulled the plug, citing health and safety concerns, and switched off all the chips. So all those people who'd had chips implanted into their right hands, which sounds a little bit biblical, maybe this is the mark of the beast they're playing about with here, suddenly had their chips switched off. Walletmore have said, it's all right, we're going to get them all switched back on again. But this is where we're going. It's all convenience, Ian, isn't it?
Yes, I don't agree with it. And I think there needs to be a much bigger debate in society about what we're going to do.
Okay, so anyway, we're going to move on now to our final item for the first part, which is looking at the BBC and Martin Bashir. And I think the best way to start is by playing a bit from this now utterly banned interview which Martin Bashir conducted with Princess Diana back in 1995. I mean, this to me is incredible, really, that the Queen of Hearts interview, as it's known, is supposedly never going to be seen again. This is an important part of history for a lady that, certainly in my view, was assassinated.
1981, the wedding of the century. Prince Charles and Lady Diana Spencer, the future king and queen. But the fairy tale wasn't to be. Tonight on Panorama, the Princess of Wales.
She won't go quietly, that's the problem. I'll fight till the end, because I believe that I have a role to fulfil. And I've got two children to bring up.
Your Royal Highness, how prepared were you for the pressures that came with marrying into the royal family?
At the age of 19, you always think you're prepared for everything, and you think you have the knowledge of what's coming ahead. But although I was daunted at the prospect at the time, I felt I had the support of my husband-to-be.
What were the expectations that you had for married life?
I think like any marriage, especially when you've had divorced parents like myself, you'd want to try even harder to make it work, and you don't want to fall back into a pattern that you've seen happen in your own family. I desperately wanted to work. I desperately love my husband, and I wanted to share everything together. And I thought that we were a very good team.
How aware were you of the significance of what had happened to you? After all, you'd become Princess of Wales, ultimately with a view to becoming queen.
I wasn't daunted, and I'm not daunted by the responsibilities that role creates. It was a challenge. It is a challenge. As for becoming queen, it was never at the forefront of my mind when I married my husband. It was a long way off, that thought. The most daunting aspect was the media attention, because my husband and I, we were told when we got engaged that the media would would go quietly, and it didn't. And then when we were married, they said it would go quietly, and it didn't. And then it started to focus very much on me. And I seemed to be on the front of a newspaper every single day, which is isolating experience. And the higher the media puts you, place you, is the bigger the drop. And I was very aware of that.
How did you handle the transition from being Lady Diana Spencer to the most photographed, the most talked about woman in the world?
Well, it took a long time to understand why people were so interested in me, but I assumed it was because my husband had done a lot of wonderful work leading up to our marriage and our relationship. But then during the years, you see yourself as a good product that sits on a shelf and sells well. And people make a lot of money out of you.
It's been suggested in some newspapers that you were left largely to cope with your new status on your own. Do you feel that was your experience?
Yes, I do, on reflection. But then here was a situation which hadn't ever happened before in history, in the sense that the media were everywhere, and here was a fairy story that everybody wanted to work. And so it was isolating, but it was also a situation where you couldn't indulge in feeling sorry for yourself. You had to either sink or swim, and you had to learn that very fast.
And what did you do?
I swam. We went to Alice Springs, to Australia, and we went and did a walkabout, and I said to my husband, "What do I do now?" And he said, "Go over to the other side and speak to them." I said, "I can't. I just can't." He said, "Well, you've got to do it." And he went off and did his bit, and I went off and did my bit. It practically finished me off there and then, and I suddenly realised, I went back to my hotel room and realised the impact that, you know, I had to sort myself out. We had a six-week tour, 4 weeks in Australia and 2 weeks in New Zealand, and by the end, when we flew back from New Zealand, I was a different person. I realised the sense of duty, the level of intensity of interest, and the demanding role I now found myself in.
Well, that's the Princess Diana there, the banned interview now, the terrible, you know, this is the discredited Martin Bashir, but brilliant interview, of course, by him, being character assassinated now by the vindictive vendetta from the Charles camp, and through the rather spineless BBC inability to stand up to anything, it seems, from the royals. Of course, the BBC is under a royal charter. And we're going to hear now from, actually, from Sean Dilley. This is just the report that which came out on Wednesday this week, where the news broke about the court appearance. So it may even have been yesterday, I'm not quite sure.
The BBC has apologised to the former royal nanny, Tiggy Leggy Berg, over a number of serious allegations they made against her by former BBC Panorama journalist Martin Bashir in order to obtain an interview with Diana, Princess of Wales, in 1995. After a hearing at the High Court, the corporation has also agreed to pay her a substantial sum in damages together with her legal costs. Our correspondent, Sean Dilley, is at the High Court and joins us now. Sean, tell us more about this.
Absolutely. Well, independent, impartial and honest were words literally etched into the BBC ID that Martin Bashir would have carried around for those years as a BBC journalist. We remember, of course, that this surrounds how the 1995 Panorama interview was obtained by Princess Diana. Many of our audience who are old enough will remember just how impactful that was, how it rocked the royal family at the time. It's since emerged that the interview had been obtained by deception, deceitful tactics as described by BBC bosses. However, in this four-page document I hold in my hand, known as a Part A statement, there are statements that have been agreed both by the claimants' lawyers and also the BBC's lawyers. Tiggy Legbork was the name that she was known by, real name Alexander Pettifer. The BBC has apologised publicly and unreservedly for the hurt they've caused, for shortcomings in the investigation into the way in which the 1995 Panorama interview was first obtained, and they've agreed to pay legal damages.
Those legal damages are £200,000, although the BBC didn't tell us at that particular point. That's now out. This is interesting that they've kind of peddled back on this, because as the director generals at the time said, well, none of this actually ever made it onto air. And we, although we, you know, we, the guidelines the BBC has to discipline its journalists are all about what actually appears on air, and none of this at this point had. These were discussions which were taking place between Diana's father and Martin Bashir. So anyway, what do you make, maybe you first, Ian, on this whole business of the Diana interview from 1995 now being banned, and also the BBC basically getting down on its knees and saying, we're sorry, our interviewer was a terrible chap?
I think it's important for the BBC, certainly when it goes forward and how it regulates its reporters and how they do things. I personally haven't really followed it. I listened to the judgment, took a view that probably the BBC took its position from its lawyers and compromised. I think it's just a very sad story, as simple as that.
Martin?
Well, I'm still at a loss to understand what's exactly happened here. It seems that there's some allegation that's floating around that T-Leg Bork had a sexual relationship with Prince Charles.
Yeah, and this was used by Bashir. Certainly it looks as if he made it up, but we're not entirely sure. Of course, the only person that could really tell us that information may be Diana herself, and she's no longer around.
Or T-Leg Bork.
Or her. But she's not going to admit to this, is she? So the point being, that was then used, and some NatWest statements were produced, desktop published by a graphic designer to make it look as if there had been some sort of cash payments had gone between her or to Earl Spencer or somehow. Anyway, so this was a way in order to basically get Bashir an interview with Diana's father, whereas his real aim was to get an interview with her. Actually, that didn't go anywhere, and he got an interview with her by another route.
Well, this is the nub of the matter. The fact is, this was a legitimate interview, and if Diana was alive today, she would probably stand by what she said. Now, the Royal Family Incorporated are trying to change the history here, and that is what
I think it's interesting you say that, because you're absolutely right. This is what the head of news at the time, Tony Hall, said to a parliamentary inquiry earlier this year on this exact subject, was that the BBC straight away got a letter from, as soon as there were any questions about this interview, got a letter from Princess Diana saying no, she wasn't coerced into doing the interview at all.
Uppermost in our minds then was, had the interview with Princess Diana, the decision that she made to be interviewed, been done fairly or not? That was absolutely uppermost in our mind. And the first investigation we did before Christmas under Tim Gardam talked to all people concerned and produced a letter where she said very, very clearly that she'd been shown no documents by Martin Bashir. She was not made aware of anything by Martin Bashir, she didn't already know, and she had no regrets underlined by the interview. And it's quite interesting that Lord Dyson himself says that an interview of some sort would probably have taken place anyway. So at that point in our inquiries and our investigations, we came to an end. Tim Gardam, there was no case to answer.
Are you seriously saying with an interview that was granted to a junior reporter with the wife to the heir to the throne that nobody questioned how that happened? Did it not cross your mind?
I'm so sorry.
Did that not cross your mind, Lord Hall?
Yes, we asked about how it had come about. But of course we did. But I go back. You trust the team of Tim Gardam as head of programmes for current affairs, the editorial policy controller, and Steve Hewlett, the editor, who is sadly no longer with us, because he would have a lot to say about this, I am sure, to ensure that the interview was properly got and that it was also properly done, as indeed it was. I just make one other thing I just want to say on this as well. Lord Dyson is very, very clear in his report, quite high up in his report, that an interview would have happened anyway. Indeed, he mentions the fact that I think the princess was going to meet with Nick Witchell at the end of August. That never took place because Steve Hewlett said, no, we're going to go down a route of Martin Bashir. So the context now we know was actually that an interview, according to Lord Dyson, was very, very likely. In this sense, Martin Bashir got it first.
So this whole idea that they seem to be putting forward that the interview was gained by deception is quite clearly not true. That's according to the guy who was head of news at the BBC at the time. Another person who was interviewed at the same time by the parliamentary committee is John Burt, who was actually director general back in 1995 when this interview took place. And as he explains here, the reason that Panorama were interviewed was because it was quite obvious that somebody had Diana under surveillance.
Did it ring any alarm bells at all, Lord Burt?
No, absolutely none. I mean, I think you can overstate the junior. He's in his early 30s. He's worked in the BBC a number of years. He's worked on other current affairs programme. He's risen up the ranks to Panorama. What I did understand and is embedded in my memory is that he didn't. I mean, I think he probably did set out to get an interview with Princess Diana, but that's not the story that was being told. What he set out was to make a panorama on the surveillance of Princess Diana's royal family. Not an unreasonable thing to do, because remember, in the previous couple of years, two private phone calls, one from Princess Diana, one from Prince Charles, had been intercepted and published. So it wasn't fanciful to assume that there were difficulties around surveillance and bugging of members of the royal family. And my understanding is that was the journey he set out on. Now, given what we now know about how he thinks and how he calculates, and given the skill with which he assembled the yarn that he took to Earl Spencer, I think we can be reasonably suspicious that he had that as his objective
all along. Yeah, but you didn't think, you know, why is Nick Whitcock this?
No, absolutely not. Okay. Why would one? You know, you wouldn't stare a gift horse in the mouth. You know, you're being told, just as Lord Hall said, he only knew a couple of weeks before. I knew even less time.
I am very surprised that you have no recollection.
I didn't say I had no recollection of events surrounding the interview, because you are quite right. This was an extremely important event in my life and that of everybody else concerned. And I have a reasonable recollection of those things where I myself was, so to speak, in the lead. And for instance, in discussion of the interview itself, whether I led the discussion about whether it was legitimate to do it, and if we did do it, what was it reasonable to ask Princess Diana, and what we shouldn't ask Princess Diana. I don't have a detailed understanding of that meeting, but I can remember the occasion, and I can remember some of the things I said, and I can clearly remember what I thought at the time. And I had to make a decision, because Princess Diana only imposed one condition, which was that she and only she should inform the Queen when the interview was done. And I had to think about that and agree it. And I can clearly remember, because my main problem, it was, as has already been alluded to, I'd had an excellent relationship with the chairman of the BBC over the best part of 10 years, but it had deteriorated over the previous year. And I don't particularly want to go into what had happened to him as the years went on and so on and so forth, but he became more and more difficult and unreasonable. And he had, and everybody knew it, very, very strong views about the royal family and things I would not repeat about his views about Princess Diana. So I had to, the hardest thing for me, and which I clearly remember, was having to decide what to do about that. And in the end, I decided he would be told essentially 7 days before transmission, but not before the interview, because I judged that if he were told, he would frustrate it, and that would have been wrong for the BBC. That was a very difficult decision for me, and in making it, one that I said to my wife at the time, I expected that I would lose my job on the back of it, but I thought it was the right decision. And I can remember clearly the events that followed that, because he made a great fuss at the board, and I had further meetings with members of the board, and in the end, they supported me.
Well, he's talking at the end there about the chairman, Marmaduke Hussey, who was married to the one of the Queen's chief ladies in waiting, and they had to be quite careful that the Palace didn't get wind of this interview before it had actually been broadcast. So, which is, I mean, it's quite an important job to do as a journalist, is to make sure that, you know, because of the content of an interview, your managers do not have the ability to compromise what you're up to. Now, I don't think there'd be any chance whatsoever of this sort of thing going out today, which is a very sad thing for me as a former BBC journalist myself. And I can also tell you that back in around about, I think it would be 1996, I was at a meeting, it was a sort of little conference with Sean Kevill, the Newsnight editor, and some other BBC executives up at the Director General Suite in Broadcasting House, chatting with Richard Eyre and saying he was the head of news, I think, at the time, and saying to him, look, you know, the BBC seems to be losing its teeth. And he said, yeah, what about the Diana interview? See, we didn't lose our teeth then. I did have to sort of say, well, yeah, okay, fair enough, that was very good. Anyway, the point being, Ian, that this is now banned. The BBC are no longer allowed to show it under false pretences. Effectively, what we've heard in court is simply not the case, that the all this stuff to do with Lord Spencer and Tiggy Leg Burke had actually nothing to do with saying that Diana was tricked into doing this interview by nefarious means by the BBC. No, she did it quite willingly, and that seems to be pretty obvious, doesn't it?
Not having followed this to the extent I think you have, I'm going to sit back and just watch what I think is an embarrassing exercise of the BBC in destroying one of its own great reporters. But the BBC has a lot of things to answer for.
Before we hear from Martin, let's also hear a little bit from a Royal Marine who was spying on Diana. So he might have been one of the people that Martin Bashir would have been spying on himself and filming, in the run-up to her death. That is 3 years after that interview was filmed.
Well, personally, I don't think that it's affecting the lads at all. They're very mature, they're well-trained. The father's really done a good job in sorting them out. And whatever their mother does is immaterial. They're well ahead of the times. Of course they are. They're well-trained in what they are. They're well-trained for what they are. It makes no difference to them. They're mature at their age. They're well aware of their...
You've had experience of them. You've been... Hang on, please.
I know more about these kids and Diana than any of you.
How?
Because I was a bloke that spied on her. I was the one who was watching her, catching her out, doing things with Hewitt.
Who for?
No comment.
What do you mean, no comment? You don't get away with that.
Doing it for a range. I was a Royal Marine. I was tasked to do something to find out what Diana was really...
Oh, so she's not paranoid then?
No,
she's not.
Oh, I see. So it is. So we were spying on her.
Of course we were.
That is an unnamed chap on the Kilroy programme, which was, that was aired around the time of the death of Princess Diana. It's quite clear that she was under surveillance. It seems pretty worrying that sort of thing didn't really come out at the time. In a way, a more important aspect of all this is now, today, which is we're going to hear now from a guy called Matt Chorley, and he does a programme on Times Radio called The Big Thing, where he talks here, and we've got another little clip. The last one on Diana, you'll be pleased to hear, maybe. Well, it's not on Diana. This one's on Prince Charles, and the fact that we've now got suitcases full of cash coming into the country in order to fund Prince Charles's mansion, where his little hideaway mansion, Argyle House, up in Scotland, and the police, the Scottish police, investigating two of his charitable trusts up there.
He doesn't respect the constitutional convention whereby, even if he happens to have opinions, he doesn't act on them. I think this is probably the problem at the heart of it. For three decades, Charles has been lobbying and advocating for causes close to his heart, some of them perfectly laudable, like restoring a dilapidated, beautiful 18th century Palladian manor. Others probably a little less laudable, like lobbying for homeopathic treatments to be made available on the NHS. But in a way, it kind of does a disservice to the debate to focus only on the weird and wacky things that he lobbies for. I mean, I do think his Foundation for Integrated Health is probably the most notorious, but he's also lobbied against modern architecture, which he happens to dislike. But even if it's great stuff, it's the fact that he feels this entitlement to lobby and advocate on behalf of his causes. That's why he set up all these charities. I mean, it's not a normal thing. The Queen doesn't have, charities through which tens of millions pass and go on to causes close to
her heart. What she does is she's the patron of existing charities, and which sort of bestows support upon them, but she's not involved in the fundraising and the day-to-day running of them.
Exactly. It's funny, like, in the newsroom, we often reflect on the word charity, but the moment that you introduce that word into a piece of journalism,
people think, oh, well, it must be good then. I mean, the charity is just a legal structure that allows people to do things in the world, to pursue objectives that the charity deems to be charitable. But the question is it right for Charles to be intervening in the world in this way?
And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Is that by pursuing good things, you know, he likes the environment, he likes, you know, building houses for communities. Well, who could object to that? And the point is that actually if you're observing the constitutional rule or the constitutional norm that you don't have an opinion on anything, then being for or against nice houses is not something that he should necessarily be sticking his oar into.
Yeah, I mean, during the we only know this because of the Guardian's years-long legal case, but, I mean, he lobbied new Labour ministers on everything from army helicopters to the Patagonian toothfish. I mean, he basically just has lots of big opinions.
Yeah.
And he acts on them. And nowhere is his opinion about how the world ought to be more visible than in Dumfries. This is basically his Charles HQ. I mean, Clarence House is his London base, but in terms of where he goes to be at peace with the world, where he feels like his values are exhibited to visitors and to all those who pass through, I mean, Dumfries House is the place. So you're right to identify that this is kind of the blank canvas on which Charles has attempted to make an indelible impact.
And actually, the fact that it's in Scotland is a long way from Westminster, and, you know, the prying eyes of the media means that a lot of this stuff probably goes a bit under the radar. So let's go back to the story that you had then yesterday, Gable. Lord Brownlow spent £1.7 million bailing out Prince Charles' failed eco-village in Knockroon in Scotland. This is Professor Alan Dunlop. He's a leading Scottish architect who criticised the plan at the time. He spoke to Times Radio earlier about why he thought the scheme failed.
His heart was probably in the right place. I was first asked about Knockroon in 2010 and the creation of Scotland's Poundbury and whether I thought it would stack up. An analysis of Poundbury in Dorchester, which has a population of mostly professional classes, some 75,000 people, in comparison to Auchinleck and Cumnock, former mining villages whose industries, textile and engineering industries, have gone, has a population of 16,000. So from that point of view, I couldn't quite see how the thing could stack up right from the very start. I'm not necessarily talking about the architecture of it and the design and the overall look of it, but just from a purely development point of view, I couldn't understand how you could possibly make it work.
So that's Matt Chorley's interviewing Gabriel Pogrund about Prince Charles's completely failed eco-village that he's been trying to build and getting Lord Brownlow to bail him out again up in Scotland. I mean, he's tried to recreate this eco-village, he calls it, although actually it's really an enormous housing estate with stone facing on the breeze blocks of the buildings that have been put there. And there's certainly the architecture is quite interesting, but he's been trying to replicate up in Scotland what's been going on in Dorchester, completely failed, and people are just not interested in buying these places, and so he's had to be bailed out.
I haven't really followed it. I think what he's done down south is an idea, a desire. I know if you look at the projects he supports, his products he sells in shops, his eco stuff that he's done with his Highgrove, he's got water recycling systems and things like that. I think he's pushing things forwards. Occasionally he upsets somebody and they have a pop. I think he should be admired for what he's doing. He will one day be king. He'll have to be quiet.
What about this? What about this whole idea of keeping out of politics, though?
Well, Queen's done it very well, no question. He's sat there for many years, wanted to take control. I think he's rightly pushed some very good things
forward. You get the idea that he's not really that keen on it. When he did the Queen's speech this year, he was kind of sort of, well, this is a bit of a chore, you know. He may also feel that that this is not, you know, he wants to change things. He wants to make the head of state more political.
I think if you're stepping in as he is to the Queen's position, it must be stressful, it must be nervous. It's something he hasn't, you know, it is a challenge.
He's had plenty of time to get ready for it, hasn't he?
Well, I don't know. Every time you do something for the first time, he learns to do it properly. I think he's taking the steps carefully. I think he's going to be a good king. Simple as that. I think where there is comment about what he's said, sometimes he may have gone too far in terms of advising ministers and things like that. But we're humans. We make mistakes. And I think, you know, give him a good chance.
Well, the Guardian has been criticising Prince Charles for changing laws after they've been signed off by the House of Commons and the House of Lords in order to benefit his own personal estate.
I'm not going to comment on that.
Anyway, Martin, what do you make of Prince Charles's, it seems, inability up in Scotland as a property developer?
Well, I mean, historically, British monarchs have had very strong political views, and it's been a gradual process whereby they've been reduced to a more ceremonial role. But of course, we're
it's
not
a question
there
of
yet.
How public those views are, though, isn't it? I mean, obviously, they will have views.
Well,
but
I would take the view that he's entitled to his views as long as they don't matter. We're not going to take any notice of them.
Okay, we'll wind up with some local stuff anyway to do with Bristol. A charity this week has denied requesting Bristol Council staff to monitor social media posts and photos of the special educational needs parents' reports. So the Bristol City Council is embroiled in basically it was effectively a surveillance scandal where they're spending public money on putting the campaigns which are legally fighting that is usually through the Liberal Democrat Party here in the city, in order to get what get the education for special educational needs, often disabled children. It's extraordinary to me, Martin, that the Labour Party, a Labour mayor, is not sticking up for disabled kids and is actually breaking the law in making sure that they get much less of an education than they're entitled to.
Well, what you're going to find all around the country is that local authorities, particularly, you know, on the officer's side, are not very keen to fund special educational needs because they haven't got a budget for it.
Well, there's a budget for the mayor's office for him flying all around the world
But in actual fact, the amount of
host
money required
for the Parliament of Mayors and this sort of thing.
Well, I mean, what local authorities actually do is a lot of child protection and social care.
Well, they also
care.
Pour money down the drain, £50 million, in Bristol Energy.
Yes, all of that can be...
The budget's there.
All of that can be true. All of that can be true.
The budget is not being spent on disabled children. No. It's being spent on little pet projects that fail.
You may well say that about Bristol City Council, but say North Somerset Council, run by the Tories, is on the verge of bankruptcy.
I thought the Labour Party cared about disabled people.
But this is an issue, isn't it? If we care about disabled children, then we've got to have a national policy
and a local one.
It can be the money can be distributed at local level, but there has to be a national budget to cover it. Otherwise, wealthier areas will be able to spend more if they want to, and poorer areas won't. And that is going to lead to postcode lotteries and all the rest of it. The obvious solution, I work in special needs in primary school, is to have a system that everybody can understand, where if you fulfil the criteria, you're absolutely going to get the money to support your child. And of course, what's actually happening at the moment with the Chancellor, Razim Bahari, or whatever his name is, he is talking about we've got to cut the special needs budget because that's one of the things we need to do if we're going to cut taxes. Now, that means that all the people around the country are trying to get special needs support. They're trying to cut that money back. Now, ultimately, as a society, when we're looking at children
it's very easy for you to blame, Martin. It's complete nonsense for you to blame Westminster for this.
No.
Nothing to do with Westminster. This is Bristol City Council pouring good money after bad in their own little pet projects and ignoring disabled people.
Well,
and actually fighting and putting under, rather than giving the money to educate those disabled people, giving that money to put them under surveillance for trying to get their rights.
That's absolutely wrong. And the way they've dealt, I mean, Tim Tent, Lib Dem councillor for wherever it is, Withywood, I think.
Whitchurch.
Whitchurch. He's done a very good job of getting parents together and taking the council to court to get this straightened out. The issue still remains that the budget for special needs doesn't exist, except the central government has said you've got to spend money on special needs, but we're not going to give you any money for it. Now, that has got to be confronted. Special needs is a major issue. We're going to have to spend more money on that. We're going to have to spend more money on the National Health Service. We're going to have to spend more money on lots of things.
We're going to spend more money on the mayor's trips around the world and his profile for his post-mayor job that he goes into.
Yeah, but I mean,
he's trying to build up a portfolio for himself.
Well, of course he is.
Sake.
Of course
well,
he is.
These disabled children are completely in this way.
Yes, but other people, you could say that, but you could say that of any politician who's got a budget for their office. It's ridiculous. The fundamentals are that there isn't any budget for special needs
even,
at national level.
Even Bristol Energy, which people were telling our mayor for about 4 or 5 years, you stop spending money on this, it's all going down the drain. Eventually it ended up £50 million down the drain. The money was there. Anyway, the other big story, well, I think is a big story, is our clean air zone that's supposed to be coming in, Ian, in November this year. Finally, it was supposed to be here in the summer. They put it off. This is for almost all cars. Which are older cars, diesel and petrol, but it's not for brand new brand new car. So if you've got a nice brand new car, 50 grand on a nice car, you don't pay anything. It doesn't sound like a kind of labour tax. Well, anyway, what do you make of the... Because it's a kind of green tax, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think I had this discussion the last time I was on with you with the Lib Dem, and we talk about the rich can afford it, nobody else can. So I'm for anything that reduces the carbon dioxide pollution, but it's got to be done in a way that everybody can afford to enjoy it.
Well, we've got some very, very good news, because actually carbon emissions from road traffic in Bristol plummeted by 20% in 2020, and the actual air quality is getting better and better all the time. And yet we're being told that there is terrible air quality in Bristol, and it's getting so much worse that... Oh, hang on, but it's not getting worse, it's actually getting better, that we need to have this special charge. The huge drop in emissions is more than the entire previous decade, according to newly published data. Now, this will clearly have something to do with the lockdowns, Martin, but, you know, there's also, of course, loads of extra bollards been put all around the city to make it more and more and more difficult for cars. So it's not surprising that the actual carbon dioxide emissions are going down. And yet we're being told we need to stop them going up. But they're not going up, they're going down.
Hang on, we've got to disentangle two things here. Carbon dioxide emissions as carbon footprints. This air quality is about pollution. It's about particulates and things of that sort in the air. Now, air quality may be improving, that's debatable. Some people might argue that it's not. But as Marvin pointed out, it's a legal requirement for local authorities to improve air quality.
Well, you know what? It's improving anyway.
Well, that's all right. Then
it doesn't need to do anything.
And probably, as you've hinted, because of the bollards that have been put in place, yeah, which people are moaning about.
But during lockdown, it improved phenomenally.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, that could be just a fluke, couldn't it?
Well, it could be, but it could also persuade people to work from home. Don't need to go into offices. Well, yeah, look at alternatives.
We need to think about wider...
Totally agree.
We've got to think for big pictures, because we're reaching a turning point, an inflection point, internationally and nationally, in the direction of our societies.
But why is it that government and local councils always impose penalties and try and restrict instead of doing it a different way? In other words, they are hitting the poorest the hardest.
Well, what we need to do is have publicly run public buses. In London, what Ken Livingstone was trying to do is actually have free public transport. That's where they were going. And they could have done it as well.
Yeah, they were blocked by the Tories, weren't they, in Bromley, my hometown. I'm afraid. But anyway, without decent public transport, I think it's just ridiculous to try and stop people driving around. And of course, the only way to do that is to make sure that you haven't got these companies like First Group, owned by the Americans, paying fat cat bosses and shareholders. Now, Ian, do you think that we'd be better off if we had a public transport system run like it was in the 1970s, say, which was actually a very good service, very comprehensive service around the city, and run at cost?
I think if you look at Europe, most of the models, there's a lot of money put in to give a subsidised cost. And I think it's a good idea, but we've got to be able to finance it. We've got to look at it sensibly. Go back to the 70s and the 60s. They were cutting back railways all over the place, you know, beaching and things like that. It was the opposite. It was a dash for the roads. We've now got to sit back and say what is right for the people in the community they're in. Localised buses, yes, but not at a cost that they can't afford.
Well, it seems that we've got hooked on oil. I mean, this is something we keep coming back to, isn't it? Since the Second World War, I think maybe this is deliberate, between Abdulaziz, the Saudi king, and Roosevelt, I think it would have been Roosevelt, not Truman, meeting at Bitter Lake in 1944, I think it was before the end of the war, decided that we were all going to get hooked on oil. Now, I'm afraid the party's over. Anyway, what did you make of the weather Monday and Tuesday?
I loved it. I loved the temperature. Fantastic.
Martin?
Well, I was in school, so obviously we were having to make sure the kids were all drinking water and so on, and we didn't actually allow them out over the lunch breaks.
So the highest temperatures ever in Britain, apparently. I think the idea that there's no global warming just seems crazy to me. I mean, I just think it's the Chinese behind all this. most of it, anyway.
Well, on that throwaway
looking at the number of reports around the country which come out Wednesday, Thursday, of set fires. People who've been, the fire brigade saying actually these fires here were set deliberately, and we're now hunting for X and Y because we've figured out that this was a deliberate fire. So it does seem as if maybe certainly some of these fires that were taking place earlier in the week were done deliberately. Anyway, look, it's been great having you in, Ian Berkeley. Barclay or Berkeley?
Barclay. Barclayhurst, actually, but
all right, that's fine. And fascinating to have your contribution and also your betting for who's actually going to win the Tory leadership contest. And we'll be back to talk about Ukraine after the break.
Thank you.
So that's the Lord of the Dance, the choir of Salisbury Cathedral, followed by the post-World War II Radio 4, or the Home Service opening theme, which the Radio 4 despicably dispensed with many years ago. I actually wrote a letter to, I think, to, I'm not sure who it was, to someone at the BBC while I was there, saying, look, you know, you're talking about changing this, don't change it. It's actually a superb arrangement. Of those tunes from around the United Kingdom, folk tunes mostly, and then we finished off there with Clannad from 1984, Robin the Hooded Man, which was a series produced here in Bristol. Or maybe, I suppose it could have been Cardiff, but no, it was HTV anyway. Fantastic drama series, which was Robin of Sherwood. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the new talkradio.co.uk stream, or newish anyway, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin, we'll start straight away on Ukraine because we've had a fascinating announcement. The Russians shape-shifting. The Russians' goals are now expanding beyond the Donbass, that is to say that breakaway region, Russian-speaking region in the southeast.
Well, I think what you're referring to is the interview that Margarita Simonyan from RT did with Lavrov, the foreign minister. And what I got from what he said was that because the West have brought in these long, relatively, they're not long-range missiles, but they're medium-range missiles, they are going to have to possibly go further than they originally intended.
But they're already further than just they're already further.
I think in any case, what the possibility of a negotiated solution would have been for them to recognise the two breakaway republics within the two oblasts within their existing boundaries, and then we can call it quits. But they've obviously had, for various operational reasons, they've had to go further than that. And don't forget, there are large sections of population in the East Ukraine, Russian speaking, who probably would have wanted independence from Kiev. But because the two breakaway republics were already under a vicious assault, didn't feel strong enough to call for it. And I think the Russians are now basically saying, just as happened in Yugoslavia, you know, we're going to have to sort this out on a permanent basis. We're going to have to draw new lines here where people, you know, we're going to change the political infrastructure.
Well, that's a very nice way of saying actually the Russians were lying about their objectives at the
start. No, they didn't say what their objectives were. They said that they recognised the two breakaway republics, and because the two breakaway republics came out this week, OSCE...
They said they were going to liberate the Donbass. That's what
right.
they said.
That's right, and they're still doing it. And to do that, you have to actually, you can't just fight in the Donbass. And in any case, they don't want to kill the population. So what they're trying to do is surround the Ukrainian army so that they can't fight and then force them to surrender, which makes, and of course you do that by getting behind them. And you can't get behind them without going into the, what is, you know, technically Ukrainian territory. The real issue here is they should have recognised the breakaway republics in 2014. That was the basis of the Minsk Agreement, which was underwritten by the French and the Germans, British and the Americans, noticeably excluded, and the obvious solution was just negotiate a solution for these republics to secede, but perhaps have autonomy within Ukraine. The Russian side were perfectly happy with that as a solution. The West wasn't interested. They wanted a conflict with the Russians. The Russians eventually took the bait, because if they have to, as far as they're concerned. Don't forget, if Ukraine comes into NATO, they've got it right on their doorstep and all the rest of it. So, and of course, they ripped up the Inter-Nuclear Forces Treaty. Virtually every treaty that they made with the Soviet Union and with the subsequent
Lavrov has ripped up the initial idea of going to liberate Lugansk and Donetsk, hasn't he? He said, no, we're not doing that anymore. Actually, what he's hinting at is we would rather like to have Odessa too, please.
Yes. And that's, don't forget, because Odessa, the massacre in Odessa, which was carried out by thugs from Dynamo Kiev and the SPU.
It would seal off Ukraine from the Black Sea completely.
That's right, all of these areas are traditionally Russian speaking. In fact, there is no such language as Ukrainian. It's actually Ruthenian, is its technical word, a technical term for their language. It's a form of Slavic language, so it's related to Russian, but it's only spoken in Galicia in the west of the Ukraine. Most people in the rest of the Ukraine do not speak it. So to have that as the national language makes no sense for two-thirds of the population who don't speak that language. And in actual fact, the one-third that does speak Ukrainian also, as it happens, speaks Russian. You can be quite sure that the Ukrainian forces are actually coordinating their fighting in Russia.
A lot of NATO are seeing to this, that a lot of the trade that would normally go through the northern Black Sea ports from Ukraine to the outside world is actually now going through Romania, isn't it? And
That's right.
One of my correspondents over in Romania has been saying that the Ukrainian refugees are, especially because a lot of those Ukrainians are in fact Romanians from that part of Romania which was taken by the Soviets. They are rather sick of this whole idea in Romania of let's help Ukraine. Well, why is that? First of all, it's frustrating to see the very rich Ukrainians who cross the border with millions of euros in cash on their luxurious cars parked in front of the most expensive hotels having more rights than Romanians themselves.
Well, the problem with the Ukraine, Yugoslavia was an artificial state, in a sense, created at the Treaty of Versailles. And, subsequently, as we know, it didn't hold together. The Ukraine has only been an independent state since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. It never existed as an independent state before that. And in actual fact, it's got a quite varied population. Yeah, in the western part of the Ukraine, there are substantial Romanian and Hungarian minorities, and there used to be a Polish minority around Lviv, but they were all massacred by the Banderistas in World War II.
These borders are becoming quite important, aren't they? And one of the things that has been agreed with the Ukrainians and between the Ukrainians and Romanians is that the Romanians will not allow any men into, only children and women are allowed to come into Ukraine, but my correspondent
not
tells,
to Ukraine, you mean Romania.
Sorry, into Romania. And my correspondent tells me that actually this is just all it is if you've got €7,000 and you're a man, you can come through no problem.
Well, it's one of the most corrupt.
You just bribe the
that's right. Well,
guards.
Ukraine has got
seven grand is the ticket to come in, and they just shut their eyes to you, and then you come.
Yes, and of course, in theory, all Ukrainian males are between the ages of 18 and 60 are going to be called up to fight the Russians. And, of course, a lot of them will not want to do that at all and will not necessarily be trying to get away. The whole thing should have been negotiated. We're reaching a point now, obviously, Vucic, who's the president of Serbia, said an interesting thing this week. He said, well, I think in the near future, the Russians are going to put another proposal on the table to settle all of this, but they're not expecting to get a sensible response. And when they don't get a sensible response, then we're going up the escalation.
There's a fascinating contrast here, isn't there? Because there has been real talks this week, there have been real talks this week going on in Tehran between Erdogan, Putin and the Iranian president. So they're sitting down actually having proper talks, and in fact, as soon as those talks are finished, the day after, there's an announcement yesterday, oh, okay, we're going to allow these sea lanes through the Black Sea now. So there are real talks going on in Tehran. The thinking coming from Moscow and from Tehran and from Ankara is that if the Americans and the Brits are in the room, you may as well not bother.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's clearly the case that the British in particular have
played, by the way, and the EU.
Yeah, but the British have undermined the French and German positions. That's what Ben Wallace, when he was pranked by the Russian pranksters, was saying, well, we've got to keep the French and the Germans out of this. It's just Britain, Ukraine and America against the world, you know. And, of course, other EU countries are not at all happy about this escalation that's taken place. It's one of the reasons why Draghi's had to resign in Italy, because the Western European economy is about to crash as a result of the policies being pursued. Everything's happening very fast now, apart from the actual military operation in Ukraine, which is basically being approached in a very systematic fashion by the Russians. I think ultimately what they're going to do is, if there is no negotiation, if there was negotiation, they may say, all right, well, we'll stop here, let's negotiate and have a ceasefire. But if there's no negotiation, and of course, Zelensky is saying never, no negotiations, Liz Truss is saying we're going to fight to the last Ukrainian, well, in that case, it will be the last Ukrainian. The Russians will simply take the bits that they think they need. I mean, from a military point of view, that's what they have to do. They have to take that whole Black Sea littoral, and they've got to link up with Transnistria, which is a Russian-speaking enclave which has declared its independence of Moldova, and all of these things, there will be a different configuration of states there, just as there is a different configuration of states in Yugoslavia has existed before 1989, doesn't exist, and the Ukraine will go the same way. It's not necessarily a catastrophe. The war itself is a catastrophe, and of course it destroys all sorts of infrastructure if it's certainly in Yugoslavia. But the idea that this is a completely unique event and we've all got to, you know, it's crazy. I mean, there's no realism in the West about how to resolve this.
Anyway, my Romanian correspondent also sent me a link to a fascinating government report, which is looking at who is it that's sending most aid and weapons to the Ukraine. Do you want to go through the first three countries, Martin, and give it a guess?
Well, I imagine the United States.
United States number one. EU number two. Now, yep. The EU is sending about one third of what the United States are, financial, humanitarian and military aid. And the United Kingdom is sending around about one tenth. So it's Britain, the EU and the UK are doing almost. But the US is sending something like two thirds of all of the aid. And Britain and the EU and the rest are around about a third.
Well, don't forget that the EU are going to take the punch in the face from the getting rid of Russian gas and oil contracts. The US isn't going to pay for that. If the US wants the Western Europeans and the East Europeans to fight the Russians in the Ukraine, they've got to get their checkbooks out. Yeah? I mean, this is the real problem, because if you're going to get an alliance together to do something like that, there's got to be into transfers between the different parties to compensate those who are going to take the most punishment. And that's simply not going to happen. Ultimately, there will be, I think the way this is going to play out, the Russians will do what they want to do what they need to do as far as they're concerned. Then they will declare a ceasefire, which won't necessarily need to negotiations. And they'll put the onus on the Ukrainian side. Well, you can carry on fighting if you like.
The Russians are not going to... Okay, so here's another take on all of this, right? So the reason the Russians may quite easily have decided, right, we're going to go beyond the borders, is really to kind of force Zelensky to come to the negotiating table.
Absolutely. If you're not negotiating, within international law, if you're not negotiating, then you can't make demands. Yeah, I mean it'll be settled.
But this
is
likely, isn't it? That if they keep extending their war aims, at some point Zelensky's going to not have anywhere left to stand on.
Well, what will ultimately happen is that it could be that the Poles will take Lviv, the Hungarians will take the Hungarian-speaking area just over the border from them, and the Romanians will take the Romanian-speaking area just over the border from them. And then there will be a Russian-speaking set of states from running along the Black Sea littoral, and there will be a Ukraine, where Ukrainian will be the main language spoken, and that's where it will be.
We've got a slightly similar thing going on in Syria, haven't we? Because various chunks of bites have been taken out of Syria over the last decade as well.
That's right, and of course that was major topic of discussion in Tehran. Also, incidentally, the Erdogan and has been brokering between the Ukrainians and the Russians the idea of, you know, we'll make sure that people normal exports can take place from the Black Sea, and the Russians are quite happy with that. I mean, they don't mind the Ukrainians exporting stuff. They've carried on supplying the Ukrainians with oil and gas all the way through the war. They could just cut them off, but they haven't done that.
But isn't there...
because they're trying to settle it with them, you know, so we don't want you to starve or freeze. We're going to kill your army because they're shooting at us. But if you stop shooting at us, then we can have a discussion about what we're going to do. And these negotiations were going quite well in Istanbul. Before the Bucha massacre, so-called, an agreement seemed to be developing, even though the Ukrainians had shot dead one of their own negotiators. And none of this was reported in the West, and now it's said, well, we can't negotiate. The problem is, from the Russian point of view, we're prepared to negotiate, but if you mess around and you refuse to negotiate and then you kill more people, the next time you come to talk to us, our demands are going to go up. Yeah, you've got to realise that's the way it works.
Ukraine does stand to lose more and more territory all the time. I mean, we'd have thought that it was obvious that Zelensky would want to negotiate in some way. Or he's also had a purge, hasn't he, this week?
Well, he got rid of his security chief as a personal
it's
friend.
It's also the chief prosecutor, I believe, has been been suspended, a bit like Mr Corbyn.
Well, what they're suggesting is that the SBU, which is the Ukrainian secret police, and they're pretty nasty. You know, they torture people, they assassinate people, they keep them in unregistered detention and so on. They are riddled with Russian spies. And you know what? That wouldn't surprise me at all. The thing about the Ukraine is that most people speak Russian just as the Russians do.
Hang on, just a
minute. Therefore, it's quite possible for people to easily communicate with each other.
There's another possibility
and infiltrate each
other's organization. That negotiator, Kiriv, was shot right at the beginning of all of this. Shot dead in the head, executed, basically.
Shot in the chest, but yes.
Well, his head didn't look too good on the picture I saw of him. Anyway, the reason for that might simply be that these negotiators are putting reasonable demands about coming to terms with the Russians, and that is considered treachery.
That's right. That's exactly what's going on. Now, Zelensky, when he was elected, promised the population, unlike Poroshenko, was clear. If you vote for me, we're going to, you know, liberate the territories we're going to war with Russia.
So anyway, it's not just one or two. It's 28 security officials have been suspended. Yeah. I mean, concerns of collaboration with the Russians. So this is all coming in the same time, basically, isn't it? As the Russians are changing their war aims, so Zelensky is sacking his security staff. So I wonder if, you know, there's more coming in, because it certainly seems pretty clear to me that NATO has a very great role to play in deciding who is going to be Zelensky's security people.
Well, that's right. And I think they prefer the new guy who's taken over, who was a professional secret policeman.
He cites unsatisfactory results.
Well, that's because the guy who was the head of the SBU officially was Zelensky's pal, and he had no background in intelligence work or anything. So, I mean, but what it shows is that...
Isn't this NATO strong-arming him, isn't it?
It may be. Let's suspend judgment on this. The real issue is that the Zelensky has blown in both ways, hot and cold. And at one stage, just after he was elected, he went down to the Donbass to talk to the more extreme elements, the Azov Battalion and so on. So, you know, a large chunk of the Ukrainian army is in fact paramilitary and an extreme right. And he tried to talk to them and said, look, we're going to have a solution here. Just withdraw your weapons from the front line and I'll negotiate. And they said, you're not doing that. And if you try and do that, we're going to kill you. So Zelensky then went back to his Western partners, no doubt the British, the Americans, etc., and said, well, I want to negotiate with the Russians here, but I've got these extremists in my country that will say they're going to kill me if I do. Can you help me? And they said, no, we don't want you to negotiate either. And this is the culpability of the Western powers, particularly the British.
Now,
they've discouraged any attempt at negotiation.
The role of chief prosecutor in Ukraine is pretty contentious, isn't it? Particularly with all the Hunter Biden stuff.
Well, they've banned eight or nine political parties that don't agree with the government.
Joe Biden got the chief prosecutor of Ukraine sacked because the chief prosecutor of Ukraine wanted to prosecute Hunter Biden.
And those associated with him.
So it does show you exactly how it works, doesn't it? Really, I mean, these chief prosecutors are just appointed by the Americans. This one particular one who's just been, she's now been dismissed formally, and she's going to take up a role in the diplomatic service, redeployed, I think they call it. She just has this rather bizarre name, Vindiktova. I mean, what kind of name is that for a chief prosecutor? Irina Vindiktova, gone.
Yeah, well, I mean, what it shows is that...
Not vindictive enough.
Yeah, well, what it shows is the disorder within the Ukrainian side. I mean, they were coming out this week, there's going to be 1 million men who are going to be armed with, and they're going to retake all of these territories. All fantasy. Ultimately, the best thing that can happen here is for the Russians to win as quickly as possible and for a ceasefire to be imposed. The sanctions on Russia are not going to be lifted under any circumstances, and that is going to create a massive political crisis in Western Europe.
Okay, also, of course, in the background to all of this, we've got to keep an eye on Taiwan, haven't we? Because as we heard from Henry Kissinger, the Americans know that if anything happens there, it's going to be all-out war. At least that's what Kissinger seems to say. And he seems to be in the know on a lot of this stuff. China has slammed the United States after an American destroyer has gone through the Taiwan Strait. Now, how much do you know how many miles there are between China and Taiwan?
Oh.
I can look it up if you don't, but...
Well, it's 100 kilometres, something like that.
Anyway, so the Americans like driving their ships between Taiwan and China.
Yes, and the issue of Taiwan could have just been parked. And the Chinese have made their red line clear. No government in Taiwan should declare independence of China. And this goes back to the agreements between Kissinger, Nixon and Mao and Chou En-lai back in the 1970s that Taiwan would be officially recognised as part of China, but that China wouldn't activate that in the short run, and that over the long term there'd have to be some kind of negotiation. And that was the status quo. Don't forget that the Kuomintang government in Taiwan for many years was a military dictatorship. The locals had no say whatsoever in what their policy was. As the country democratized, more indigenous forces, mainly made up of people who lived there for generations, wanted to have an independent. They didn't, you know, they didn't want the Kuomintang running things. They didn't want to be an alternative government of China. They just wanted to be Taiwan as it is.
So it's 100 miles off the coast. The Americans have surely they've got a right to sort of slide their warships through there, haven't they? Just like the even the Russians, if they wanted to, could sail down through the Irish Sea if they felt like
that's
it.
Right.
Or the channel?
Yeah, they can, but of course you can do it, but it's going to be regarded as provocative. And the same thing happened from when they flew those B-52s from Fairford all the way along the front line in Eastern Europe over the Donbass, etc. And of course the Russian interceptor planes had to come up because these are nuclear armed bombers. Yeah, so you're going to want to intercept
there
them.
There is a
now you can do these kind of operations, FONOP operations as they're called, freedom of navigation operations, but they're provocative. If
President
the Russians did them
Martin,
to us, we wouldn't like it.
President Xi will be watching what's going on in Ukraine like a hawk, won't he?
Well, everybody is watching everything else because the situation is potentially disastrous. You know, it's going to be World War One with nuclear weapons. And if somebody makes a silly mistake.
Well, what I'm trying to say here is that as the Russians are doing better in Ukraine, it doesn't look as if, I mean, this is chugging along, this war. Not as many people are dying as if it was an all-out war of some kind. Quite large chunks of Ukraine are now in Russian hands, large oblasts, as they call them. They're gigantic counties that they have, which are supposed to have some sort of autonomy, or a lot less autonomy now than they did have under the previous pre-2014 government, which would have been Yanukovych, is it?
Yeah.
So they're watching this. They're watching this. They're watching the Russians succeed, being very successful militarily against the proxy forces of the US over in Ukraine, and they're thinking, well, maybe we should just go and grab Taiwan.
Well, I think what
there's nothing they can do.
No, what their position is our red line is that no government in Taiwan should declare independence because that on that point we will invade. Yeah, they've made that clear. Now, the obvious answer for that from the Taiwanese side is not to declare independence. Just say we're not going to do that. And the democratic forces in Taiwan could do us everybody a great favour, including themselves, by just contacting Beijing and saying, look, under no circumstances are we going to demand independence for Taiwan. We accept that it is officially part of China.
They've got independence.
Well, exactly. On practical terms, in practical terms, they have. Yeah? But they haven't got a seat at the United Nations. Now, Abdullah Öcalan, who's in prison in Turkey, and the PKK, they're not fighting for an entirely independent Kurdistan. They want an autonomous Kurdistan within Turkey. That is their current position. Now, around the world, one of the things that was discussed in Tehran was the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And they've all got different interests there. In actual fact, all of these conflicts, the ones in Georgia and South Ossetia and Abkhazia, there's lots of these little conflicts all over the world. And people have to accept that you're not necessarily going to get out of this an independent country with a seat at the United Nations and a World
so
Cup
is,
team
is the House,
in the football.
Is the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi going to go to Taiwan? This is apparently the very last thing in the world that the Chinese won't see.
Well, they've told them that she shouldn't go, because it's provocative, and I think
she has declined to confirm. We hear today that she will be making.
Yeah,
a
well, what Biden said in an off-the-cuff remark was, "I think she's going to go, but the military, his own military, the Pentagon, aren't very happy about it."
Well, media reports earlier this week said that Pelosi will visit Taiwan in August, drawing sharp warnings from Beijing against these travel plans. Now, I mean, surely she can go there if she wants to. I mean, it might annoy the Chinese a bit, but they can't really do anything to stop her. Surely.
Well, if you want to stop a war around Taiwan, you better listen to what the Chinese are saying. Yeah? And now you could say, well, we're entitled to do this. Okay, do it. And then if the Chinese invade, what are you going to do then? because the Chinese can invade. There's no doubt about it. It's not clear that the United States would win such a war. Why would they? If the Chinese tried to take over Alaska, they'd probably find that the Americans would be able to stop them. If they try and take over Taiwan, but boots on the other foot, then, you know, they've got a big base in China there. They've got all the kit they need. They could sink the entire U.S. Pacific fleet. Quite simple. And of course, they said, well, then they'd sink your fleet, but we haven't got one.
Anyway,
so the ones with a fleet, we're going to sink it.
She may not be going, we shall see. She doesn't want to confirm nor deny, you know. She's not really saying anything about it, I suppose.
That's because they're at sixes and sevens about what to do, Tony.
Yeah, she hasn't managed to get permission from whoever's in charge, who certainly isn't Biden. Pelosi is also now saying to Blinken today, she wants to designate Russia. So she wants to take the Chinese and the Russians on at the same time. Designate Russia as a state sponsor of terror. And if the Congress are considering doing that too. According to a report from Politico, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told Secretary of State Antony Blinken to designate Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. Or if he doesn't do it, Congress will do it. Cited two sources familiar with the call who said the conversation happened earlier this week. Well, it's only a little chit-chat. But, I mean, what is the point of designating Russia as a state sponsor of terror when we've had all this nonsense from the Americans to do with the takeover and the terrorism in the Middle East ever since the turn of the century?
Well, I mean, the problem for the political elites in the US now is that they're trapped by their own extreme rhetoric. In order to get anywhere politically in the US, you have to sound harder line than the next guy or gal. And that means that even if somebody sensible was in charge saying, hang on, let's just dial this back a bit, they would be shouted down by all these other numbskulls. Now, that is very bad news for humanity, because that means we're unlikely to get any sensible discussion to prevent escalation into full-out war. And this is a very real danger. And of course, the consequences could be absolutely catastrophic. Paul Craig Roberts, if people know who he is, who used to be one of Reagan's economic advisors, but is now, you know, he knows that 9/11 was an inside job, as is David Stockman, who also was an economic advisor of Reagan. They are saying that he is encouraging the Russians to take a harder line, saying, don't negotiate, you've got to, the only thing the Americans understand, I'm an American and I used to be in the Reagan administration, the only thing they understand is force. Don't try and negotiate with me, wasting your time. I think that's a bit extreme myself. And I think the Russians are doing the best they can to keep lines of communication open. They're not going to crash the Western economy. As long as they pay in rubles, they can have gas and oil. And they're trying all the time to talk to the population in the Western countries over the heads of the politicians who they know are a waste of time.
Well, yeah, absolutely right. There's a bit of pushback in Europe against the US plans to make sure this war in Ukraine, Zelensky wins. Clearly, that's impossible, but there is some pushback from the Europeans, quite a lot of them. There's only three countries, really, that have been supplying lots of weaponry and money to Ukraine. Many of the other ones that promised they would haven't really sent anything at all. Like the Romanians, for example, who have decided they're going to do other things, like they'll help them to use their ports and things like that, but they're not going to be actually really supporting them financially. They've got much bigger priorities at home. But anyway, last week, Tucker Carlson on Fox was talking about the pushback going on in America against the $40 billion which are going towards Ukraine. They're saying, well, hang on, we need this in America.
Joe Biden, in the name of democracy, signed a $40 billion aid package, not for you or any other American, but for Ukraine. And that money, Joe Biden says, is just the beginning. It's part of our unlimited commitment to funding Ukraine's corrupt and authoritarian government. Here's Biden.
For as long as it takes. Does it mean indefinite support from the United States or Ukraine? Or will there come a time when you have to say to President Zelensky that the United States cannot support his country any longer? Thank you.
We are going to support Ukraine as long as it takes. We are going to stick with Ukraine, and all of the allies are going to stick with Ukraine as long as it takes.
The war has pushed prices up. They could go as high as $200 a barrel, some analysts think. How long is it fair to expect American drivers and drivers around the world to pay that premium for this war?
As long as it takes. So Russia cannot, in fact, defeat Ukraine and move beyond Ukraine.
Future generations will look at that tape and many tapes like it with their jaws open. As long as it takes, whatever the cost for Ukraine. As the American economy heads toward total destruction, Ukrainians are dying in large numbers. Who's winning? Well, Ukrainian oligarchs. They're getting richer, much richer. Since January of this year, the Biden administration has sent about $8 billion just in so-called security assistance alone to Ukraine. That would include missile systems, howitzers, ammunition, radar systems, et cetera, et cetera. Now, defense contractors are making a ton from them, this, and that's why they have lobbied for it so hard. But you have to ask, once we send these weapons to Ukraine, where do they go then? What happens to them? These are sophisticated and deadly weapon systems. Well, no one knows where they go. No one's keeping track. U.S. officials, Biden administration officials, have admitted that to the Wall Street Journal, and we're quoting, once U.S. equipment, materiel, is handed to the Ukrainian government, U.S. officials said they have little direct knowledge of where that materiel goes. They rely instead on the Ukrainian government for such information. The administration has not agreed to allow American military troops to conduct some oversight into that country, end quote.
Obviously, I think Rand Paul in the Senate, is he in the Senate now or the Congress? He was the dissenting voice about sending money to the Ukraine, saying if we're going to send money, we're going to have an audit of what this money is.
Well, yeah, right.
And
what he's pointing out there's no audit at all. This money is just and money and weapons are just being handed over to the Ukrainians. And I think I'm not sure if we talked about it last week, but you reckon that they're even being sold on to the Russians?
Yeah, a lot of it is ending up in Albania. That's the international bazaar for buying this kind of stuff. Some of it has been sold to the Russians, and not so much to the Russian mainstream military, but to the militias, the forces of the breakaway republics, and some of it has actually been just destroyed by Russian action. And one of the things the Russians are saying is that the people who are firing these new super-duper Wunderwaffen are, in fact, NATO military personnel because the Ukrainians don't know how to use them.
At the end of the day, where do you think this is going to go, Martin? Are we going to see some sort of split-up of Ukraine in a similar way to Yugoslavia, that sort of thing?
Well, yes. I mean, it's already happened. It's not something that might happen. It's already happened. It's happening in front of our eyes.
When they keep saying we're going to take as long as it takes, it doesn't really mean anything.
Well, what they mean by that is...
It's going to take till doomsday. He means till doomsday.
I think the strategy, yes, and it could literally be doomsday if it turns into a nuclear confrontation. But I think what the original strategy was that if we get the Russians engaged in a war in the Ukraine, this will wear them out. But in actual fact, it's transpired that it's actually the West that is going to be worn out long before the Russians.
But it's a bit of tension.
If you think about it, it was pretty obvious because the Russians have got a huge country with virtually every raw material you can imagine, and the West basically has got a financial system that's like a Swiss
cheese. There's a bit of tension between the Belarusians and the Russians emerging after Lavrov has announced that he's going to just kind of chug on and we're going to take some more territory over in Ukraine. Belarus's President Lukashenko says the Ukraine war must end to avoid a nuclear abyss. The Belarusian leader said Moscow, Kiev and Ukraine's Western backers need to agree to stop the fighting. We must stop, reach an agreement, end this mess, operation and war in Ukraine, Lukashenko told AFP. Let's stop and then we will figure out how to go on living. There's no need to go further. Further lies the abyss of nuclear war. There's no need to go there. How correct is he in talking about? Is he scaremongering?
No, the danger of nuclear war is palpable. It's something that George Monbiot might like to put his mind to when he's talking about getting rid of farming because of cow farts. The real dangers to the environment are absolutely staring us in the face. And Lukashenko there is demonstrating that he wants to be a mediator between the Russians and the West, which has always been his traditional role. He's not a nutcase at all. The problem is that the things are getting out of hand now because the West doesn't want and seems to be incapable of negotiating.
We've had an hour. We haven't mentioned the Israelis really, have we? Once in our international roundup, the Israeli airstrikes have killed 3 Syrian soldiers near Damascus. Most missiles are fired from Israel were intercepted overnight Thursday night into Friday. Syrian officials say Israel carried out a flurry of airstrikes against Syria, hitting areas around the capital, Damascus, killing three soldiers and wounding seven others. Syrian media also reported damage caused in and around the strike, but did not clarify what was hit. Israel, as usual, did not offer any details either. This is an undeclared war going on.
Well, it's been an undeclared war for decades, and it's still going on. And, of course, there's no legal basis for the Israelis to bomb things in Syria. They haven't got a legal basis for it.
Well, the Israelis rather like it matters. Flying They're going to around. Do it anyway. They send missiles. They also like flying around. Do you think one of those Israeli planes might come down at some point?
Well, the Russians have always got the option, if they want to shoot the Israeli Air Force out of the sky.
So really, the Russians are collaborating with the Israelis to bomb Syria, really, aren't
well,
they?
Well, no, what you'll find is that Andrew Korybko is a journalist, he's not a journalist, he's a geopolitical analyst based in Moscow. And what you've got to recognise is that the Russians always try to negotiate with whoever it is that they're dealing with. So then, you know, Putin went to see Mohammed bin Salman soon after Biden had been to see him, and I had a much friendlier meeting. And what the Russians are trying to do, they want Saudi Arabia to join the BRICS alliance, along with Iran. They want Pakistan and India to join the alliance. And so what the Russians are trying to do is get traditional enemies. Don't forget, they've had a lot of bad blood with the Turks, but they still talk to them. That is their style. It's only the West that bangs its shoe on the table these days and say, we're not talking to them, we're going to fight to the finish. We don't negotiate. And of course, what that means ultimately is you are isolated. People are beginning to just ignore the troublesome child in the corner there who insists on fighting all the time, wants sanctions on everybody. Nobody in the rest of the world, apart from Europe, has put sanctions on Russia. Nobody. They're not interested.
Also, Martin, you went to see the Julian Assange film, Ithaca, on Monday this week here in Bristol. We were plugging it, our little tour. How did it go?
Well, I turned up to watch the film of some people I recognise in the audience, not least David Miller, who's on this show the other week. And we watched the film, and then there was a sort of quick Q&A, some more sensible questions than others. Some people got up and made statements.
Give us a little review of the film. What are the things that stood out?
I spoke to Gabriel, who made the film, and I said, well, it's a good film because it takes a human interest angle. So you don't have to have any background knowledge to watch it. You can just watch it.
Is there a couple of memorable bits from the film itself? The documentary?
Well, I mean, the real hero of the film is Julian's dad. Because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, footage of him talking to camera and talking to people. And it's kind of about him and about Stella, obviously, the Julian's wife. And all of the facts are in there, but some young people come to watch it. They didn't know all of this stuff, and they were, you know, it was a good way to get people to take notice of the wider issues.
Hmm. Ultimately, though, this Espionage Act, which is what this is all about, if you look at other people that have been prosecuted under the Espionage Act, and people like Daniel Ellsberg and Glenn Greenwald have pointed out. That actually, if it looks almost as if Julian Assange had gone back, had basically handed himself in and gone to the States, if he was treated like the actual leakers of this information, people like Chelsea Manning, he'd probably be out by now.
Yeah, because the Obama administration realised they did punish Chelsea Manning because she had, you know, she'd signed the Official Secrets Act or the equivalent in the US. I think I was talking to Gabriel and Julian's dad about the Baratza, who's the magistrate, saying that she can't extradite him to the US because she accepts that he's got a suicide risk as a medical issue. And I was saying to them, well, what I thought was happening there is the British are trying to find a way out here. They've got to keep the Americans happy.
But I'm just bothered because this whole process with Julian is dragging on such a long time, over a decade, well over a decade, is it feasible that, you know, if Julian had gone to the States, been prosecuted, he may be out of jail by now, like people like Chelsea Manning are?
Well, I think that's, don't forget, Pompeo was talking about poisoning him.
That's because he was over here. He was in the Ecuadorian embassy. Yeah, if he hadn't tried to put up a fight. Anyway, I just think it's an interesting angle on all this. And I'm not criticising them at all for it, because I understand they may feel that, you know, that he would never have been let out of jail if he'd gone over there.
In any case,
but it's almost as if he's been dragged into this situation where, you know, his punishment has not even really started yet, even though it's been going on for, say, 12 years or so.
Exactly. He's being extrajudicially punished. Yeah, the process itself is a punishment, and it's also, in international law terms, completely illegal, and in British law terms. And if people think that it doesn't matter that the British state thinks it can do things like this, then they're deluded. This is exactly how freedom was destroyed in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, by this kind of show trial, and then people not recognising what was behind it and what would come next and what would come after that. I think the deep state in the US has dug a hole for itself here. Once you've lost your secrets or whatever and they've been out there, punishing people for leaking them is irrelevant. You know, all you're doing is drawing attention to your own malfeasance.
Mm. In terms of just skipping to a subject we were covering earlier, the fuel increases. We've had more protests today on Britain's roads, the Go Slow protests on the motorways. What about, there's a campaign now, a Guardian reports, calling for 1 million British consumers to stop paying their energy bills. Can't pay, won't pay.
Well, this kind of tactics were pursued by the radical movement in Italy in the 1970s, and I was very interested in these kind of things at the time. The problem is, can you make it stick? Like any strike, any kind of direct action like that.
What they're saying is that if everybody doesn't pay these bills, then there's nothing that these electricity companies can do. And they must be getting a little bit nervous that people are getting organised against them, because these increases in prices have just seemed to be totally draconian and unforgivable.
Well,
especially when the oil price, for example, is coming down. This is a kind of green levy that they're putting on.
Well, it's also the manipulation of the market by the multinationals that control it. I mean, they make money whatever the price is.
A lot of people are thinking, well, we're being punished for the pollution that China is chucking into the atmosphere.
Well, yeah, but you always bring it back to carbon taxes. The reason why the oil price is going up is because of the sanctions on Russian oil.
It's going down.
The international price is still going up, Tony.
No, it's not. It's going down. The oil prices have been going down for the last couple of weeks.
All right. Well,
that's not what this is about. This is about whether you're going to have taxes here because China is chucking out loads of fossil fuels into the atmosphere.
We were on Ukraine, but we've come back. You're looking to talk about China's carbon emissions. The argument of the Global Commons Institute, which started this ball rolling back in the 1990s, was that there was a historical debt by the industrialised nations.
So we have to now pay for the Industrial Revolution. People have got to pay extra money now.
For
people who died 200 years ago.
Listen.
This is bonkers,
Tony,
Martin.
Tony, let me just talk you through this, okay? Let's presume, for the sake of argument, that carbon emissions cause global warming. Now, some people may argue about that, but let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that that's what we're saying. Now, that means if we've got to reduce carbon emissions, it's got to be done on a fair basis. And the only fair basis is that those countries in the past, which have created most of the carbon pollution, will have to pay, so that other countries, which are going to need to industrialise,
How about the wealthy people and the energy companies pay rather than the poor consumers?
Well, what we're actually talking about here is a global revolution, possibly led by the Chinese Communist Party.
But
and
it sounds to me like you're saying
redistribute wealth.
You're saying bring it on. Just let's make the poor people really poor, so they have to have a revolution.
No, Tony. I'm not saying any such thing. I'm a sceptic about global warming. But any arrangements that you have to make, there's all sorts of other things. Let's put global warming out of the picture altogether. There are other things.
It's about energy prices whether there's going to be a revolt against energy
prices.
Yes, and
there's a question of the use of scarce resources like coal and oil, and who gets to
use
them.
Well, coal is not that scarce, actually.
Well, yes, I know, but it's also... Is it viable?
Just over the River Severn.
Yes, okay, but anyway, the point is, Tony, that none of these things can be resolved if we're on a collision course with China and Russia. We're supposedly negotiating because we're all on this tiny little spaceship about various problems that we've got.
Is it simply that we're too scared?
But we can't do that because we're at war.
Even though the Chinese are creating all these emissions, we're too scared to take them on, so we would rather tax our own people.
No, Tony. The agreement at the moment, the Chinese have agreed to try and limit their emissions on the understanding that they will be compensated by the wealthier countries. The same goes for the very poor countries in Africa. They are going to be allowed to increase carbon emissions because they've got them, and they've got to be compensated if they're not.
Yeah.
And there's got to be redistribution on a global level from very poor
people.
We've
had it too good too long, so our poor consumers are going to go bankrupt.
The people in the West have had it too good too long, and I'm not just talking about the wealthy. We've invaded 7 countries in 10 years. We've killed millions
of people. We're talking about consumers of energy, Martin.
No, we're talking about citizens of our country. Citizens of everybody's country.
So they have to pay for the bad things that their leaders have done.
Shall I tell you what's going to happen?
Have done 200 years ago.
It won't be to do
200 years ago.
It won't be to do with carbon.
The Industrial Revolution.
Yes,
what are you talking about?
And slavery and all the rest of it, Tony.
So that's why their fuel prices are going up, is because of slavery and the Industrial Revolution.
Can I just make a point?
Is this just totally illogical?
Liz Truss has said that we're going to need a Marshall Plan to rebuild Ukraine, and we're going to fight to the last Ukrainian. Mm. What that implies is rationing of energy. Because if we're going to war, Tony, there's going to be certain things you're not going to have.
Well, there won't be no rationing
for
the rich.
No, there will be rationing.
There won't be rationing for the rich, will there?
In the Second World War, there was rationing for the rich. And in actual fact, one of the things that happened during the war is that the average person actually ate better than they had done in the 1930s. And we're talking about having war, but that just meant that in actual fact, rationing wasn't for poor people a problem.
Anyway,
rationing's a problem for rich people, which is why they don't like it.
I just think it's bonkers to talk about people have got to be punished with their fuel bills for the Industrial Revolution. That's just crazy.
Slavery?
Yeah.
What about the invasion of Iraq? What about all of the things that this state has done in our name?
You seem to carry a lot of baggage, don't you?
No.
Britain is carrying all this baggage. So Britain has got to be punished for all these things.
No, Britain has got to...
I don't think anyone out in the world's really got the stomach for seeing Britain punished for the Industrial Revolution.
There's plenty of people out there who used to be part of the British Empire who actually feel that they were ripped off by the British Empire. There's a very good book on what Britain did to India. And it's quite clear that India is a much less prosperous place than it would have been
Indians have got this grudge that they really want to punish the Brits? I don't think so. Martin, we're going to be talking about this all forever, but anyway, let's just draw a line under it there.
Imperialism is a crime, and
the British people have got to pay.
No, the wealthy in Britain have got to pay, but
the wealthy in Britain will be paying nothing. Because they're going to get off scot-free out of all these increases. For example, if you want to drive around Bristol, you've got to have it. If you've got a brand new Chelsea truck, you're not paying a penny.
All right. I suggest that we're going to have rationing, nothing to do with global warming, because we're going to war and there will be rationing of fuel and things like that. Mm. And that is what's going to happen, and people better get used to it, because that's what's going to happen. That's definitely going to happen. Mm. There will be fuel rationing. They're already talking about it in Germany and in other countries.
And that is we're going to have a war in the Middle East. We need to make sure that we are able to cope with no oil coming in. Anyway, can we please get on to this interview I did with Peter Williams? He's written a book. He's a former producer from This Week, the ITV documentary series in the 1970s and 1980s. His book is called Being There. And here is a section where he talks about the illegal invasion of Iraq. Because, of course, he's calling it Being There because he was there. He was making documentaries for ITV about all these things, and he met many interesting people in his career.
We went to war in Iraq based on a lie. This is obviously a very political area in which to express your views. But from the work that I've done, I'm convinced that much of what Andrew Gilligan said on the BBC before the dodgy dossier was produced, much of what he said following his interview with David Kelly was basically true. You will remember that not only was this something which you will remember well that the 45-minute claim which our Prime Minister, our then Prime Minister Tony Blair said, was never substantiated. In my view, that claim that weapons of mass destruction could be rained down on Britain within 45 minutes, that was one of the prime reasons that influenced public opinion to go to war. As we all know, no evidence has ever been produced to indicate that that was true. The subplot of that, of course, is that it brought government into head-on conflict with the BBC. Greg Dyke, who was then Director General, his instinct, and I know him well, his instinct is to support his troops. And his instinct was to defend Gilligan from the outset. He did his own work, and I believe he was satisfied in his own mind that Gilligan was substantially correct. That didn't save him from his job. It didn't save him from fierce criticism, both from Alistair Campbell and from Tony Blair. And he and the chairman, Gavin Davis, both left the BBC. I think that is a wrong that has never been righted. As far as I know, no apology has ever been issued to Greg or to Gavin. And I think that's part of the Kelly story. I think it was also deeply unhealthy that the BBC was seen to bow the knee to government pressure. I think the BBC governors at that time have a lot to answer for.
Well, I hadn't heard that interview before, but obviously I agree with it. Apart from that, it was based on a lie in this country. But of course, we know that Tony Blair had told George Bush that he was prepared to support them anyway, even without a UN resolution. But of course, it was the protests and so on which led to a situation where they had to come up with an excuse to invade Iraq. So that was weapons of mass destruction.
Just afraid of the Americans, basically.
He wasn't even afraid of the Americans. He was in bed with them. He promised them more than they wanted. You know, he was basically, you know, instead of defending what I would regard as Britain's national interest to try and stay out of it, as the French and the Germans did, he was actually jumping into bed with them and demanding that he should be. I mean, at one stage, the Americans said to me, "See, we've got problems at home, Tony. Maybe we can let you off being involved in the war." He said, no, we want to be involved. He could have just taken that and said, "Yeah, we have got problems, we can't get involved." But he didn't do that, did he?
No, amazing. Anyway, also Peter, I also asked Peter about an interview that he had with James Jesus Angleton. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this guy, Martin? Because he was a victim of Kim Philby, wasn't he? He was Philby, the British spy. He was actually a Soviet spy working for the British, managed to get just about everything, all the secrets there were, from the CIA's counterintelligence chief, Angleton. Who was this James Jesus Angleton that Peter interviewed?
Well, he was head of counterintelligence at the CIA. So basically, he's a mole hunter. He's looking for who the enemies are. And in actual fact, he was a delusionary paranoid. He saw enemies in every, you know, he had his own office.
It must have been quite easy for the Russians to play him.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's money, ideology, coercion, anyway, ego, you know. But anyway, the thing about him was that he also pushed the idea. I mean, what the more mainstream CIA people were saying, well, the Russians and the Chinese just don't get on. You know, they hate each other. But he was saying, no, it's a trick. It's a trick. In actual fact, underlying all of this is an underlying communist conspiracy. And then in actual fact, the Russians and the Chinese are pretending not to like each other, but it's not true. Total rubbish.
Maybe he'd heard that from Henry Kissinger, who knows. But anyway, look.
Kissinger had a better understanding than Angleton.
Probably, yeah. Anyway, let's have a listen now to, this is Peter Williams again, just talking about the interview that he did with James Jesus Angleton from the CIA.
Every meeting must have been like a game of chess. I mean, this is a man who had huge power. This is a man who was able to whether legally or illegally, open every letter he wanted to open that went through the US mail. And he had a special department set up to do that. And that included snooping on congressmen and senators and a variety of other people. It was an extraordinary power that he had.
That's Peter Williams just talking about the power of Angleton. But then I finished up by asking him about the Cashless Society, because we had our Debbie Hicks and our rally about Keep It Cash here. What did you make of that? He's in his 80s now, I believe.
I've got to be partisan here. I'm 89. I'm fairly conversant with new media and that sort of thing. But I live near a town called Faversham. The last bank in the town is about to close, and we are told, oh, well, you can do it online. There are a generation, which will soon be gone, of people who find it very difficult, and some, through disability or whatever, almost impossible to conduct their lives online. And I think there is, although I have to say, in the COVID instance, the vulnerable have been well looked after. But there is a tendency to say, to look to the future and ignore the present. There are hundreds of thousands of people who will not even begin to understand what a cashless society is. And that's a fact.
So he's saying the cashless society is not a good idea, Martin. He's not.
Well, I mean, we're all
wants to keep a bit of cash.
Broadly in agreement with
that. And we're shutting bank branches. In fact, I think once most of these bank branches are gone, I mean, it's all just been happening in the EU faster than it is here. There's going to be no choice, is there? Obviously, you need money to live, and you need to buy food, that sort of thing. Unless you've got a nice little cottage garden, a kitchen garden, to grow your own food, and you're not actually trading, just eating stuff, you need money. So you're not going to have any choice, are you?
No, and I think, as I say, the people in the Bank of England are talking in terms of we've got to keep. Cash has got to be an option. And I think, you know, common sense suggests that we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket, no, whatever that not. Basket no, is.
Especially when it comes to hacking and things like that. This is one of the reasons I don't like the smart meters. Anyway, thanks very much, Martin. We're going to finish this week with a clip from, bless him, old Dr. Vladimir Zev Zelenko. And the final interview he did with Anne van der Steel. He also takes a look at one of the most interesting issues in our world today, which is this new form of fascism which has developed called transhumanism.
We're dealing with people that don't believe in God. And if they do worship, they don't worship God. They worship something else. They also don't believe in an afterlife. No world to come. And if you ask them one simple question, what happens to human consciousness when someone dies? They say it goes away, extinguishes, oblivion, nothing. This is what they say, not me. And the one thing that these degenerates up to this point haven't been able to accomplish is escape death. But they don't want to die because there's nothing, and now here they're all powerful, right? They're billions, they control humanity. So there have been the last 30, 40 years working, spending billions, working on technology that they believe. I'm not sure if it's possible or not, but they believe that they can create a new life form, a hybrid, organic, inorganic platform with artificial intelligence. But more importantly, they can download their consciousness into that humanoid life form. And so, you know, they have a problem. This physical body at some point begins to break down, right? And so everyone dies. So they want to transfer their consciousness into this new artificial body life form and escape death. And then when that machine begins to break down, they'll just download it into the newer version, 2.0. It sounds like fantasy, it sounds like science fiction, except Except that's what they're messaging. That's what they're spending their... Listen to Elon Musk. He says it outright. Listen to Ray Kurzweil, the famous futurist. Or Yuval Noah Harari. Now, this is a bad boy. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about him. He is called the prophet by Klaus Schwab, Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, and Obama calls him his favorite author. He did it on CNN. So what does Yuval Noah Harari say? He's just one man, a little short guy. But he is messaging and influencing the thought patterns of the richest and most powerful people on the planet. So maybe we should know what he says. He says the following. This is a verbatim. Look it up. Humans are hackable animals. If you can hack an animal, you can engineer it with intelligent design. But not with some god intelligence above the clouds, but with human intelligent design. For we are now gods. There's no free will. There's no soul. And, this is my favorite, COVID-19 will be an inflection point in history when 24/7 digital surveillance went under the skin. It's interesting. You know, in 2016, Klaus Schwab gave an interview on a French media platform. I saw it with subtitles. And he said something extremely puzzling. No one could figure it out. That by in 10 years, by 2026, every single human being will be tagged with a digital identifier internally. So before I ask you why, I'd rather ask how. How do you logistically get 7 billion people to willingly get injected or implanted with some type of technology that allows for them to be surveilled? Well, I have an idea. Mm-hmm. How about you manufacture a global crisis, create global fear, psychosis, then offer a false solution, which has nothing to do with COVID-19, because if it did, why would we vaccinate 6-month-old children?
That's right.
According to the CDC, children have a 99.998% chance of recovery from COVID with no treatment. It's actually safer than the flu. There's no medical reason to inject them with something that is leaving the Sherman March is child's play compared to what this vaccine is doing. It's a carnage. Why would I inject that into a child? Not for medical reasons. There are other reasons, which we'll discuss. But one of them is to transition the world to a world of maximum control, surveillance, and in other words, slavery. You know, slavery has been a biblical and historic phenomenon. Even in this country, 150 years ago, we had slaves. I mean, it's not that long ago. And in many parts of the world, they still have slaves. Why? Because slavery has always been the most lucrative commodity and business venture in history. So there is a component here of controlling human behavior.
Okay, so that's Zev Zelenko there, winding the show up for today. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, Ian Barclay, originally from the Brexit Party. Now, he was just telling us, thinking of starting, in the process of starting his own political party, absolutely fed up, as many of us are, with the two main parties and British politics generally. Which is, of course, isn't it exactly what the fascists want? Exactly what the fascists want is to have a dysfunctional democratic system so they could just come along and say, hey, guys, what we need is a kind of fascist system, isn't it? Well, they won't call it that, of course, because that democracy, it don't work. So let's make things better. And, of course, it will be better for a while. Anyway, you can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast full-length interviews, story links, the comment page, and our email addresses, Martin and I, if you want to email us. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Yes, I send out an email every week, usually on a Sunday evening, which has got all the links to anything if you're interested in following it up on there. But of course, that is there on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Anyway, my paperback's about deals with the Allies and the Nazis during the war. That is the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. That costs £15. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem. And also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're on eBay, and the Siege of Heaven ebook and links are all of them. You can get links to all of them via www.bilderberg.org. And if you get a little warning saying, "Oh, this site is dangerous," just ignore it or say, "No, it isn't." And you can go there. Everything's fine. It's just, I think there's some sort of security certificate on the site that I'm trying to get my ISP to renew it, but they haven't done it yet. Anyway, so this show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. There's also a app now, the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which you can download from Google, Google Play, but possibly other places too. You can also hear this show repeated over lunch at Camberley's RadioQUK.com. I think we do that on Saturdays and Sundays too. Do please make live recordings if you want. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the collaborators who own many of these transmitters and printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich, trying to move in, aren't they? So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for our Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.